And welcome to our monthly board meeting. All right, so let us begin with the Pledge of Allegiance. And the flag is now here. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, may we have the roll call, please?
Good evening, commissioners. I'll take the roll call. Chair Hartwig?
Present.
And Vice Chair Hurd is excused. Commissioner Castillo?
Present.
Commissioner May?
Present.
Commissioner Montgomery?
Present.
Commissioner Pitts?
Present.
And Commissioner Jung Lee? Thank you.
Okay, on to item 3, approval of last month's minutes.
I so move.
Oh, move. Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Abstentions? Nays? Okay, carries unanimously. Old or unfinished business, having none. Are there any modifications to the agenda?
Yes.
Okay.
I have requested, and I'm going to request once again, that item D be tabled at the present time.
Okay. Do we need to vote on that, or can we just act on it?
I don't know.
Just move on.
Okay. Item D is withdrawn. Okay, moving on to item A.
Item A, good evening, commissioners. Was the last item tabled or withdrawn for the next meeting?
Pardon?
You want it withdrawn, correct?
Item D.
Tabled.
So it should come back as old business or come back, or you'll let me know?
To another time. We haven't specified.
And you'll let me know?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Moving on. Item A. Item A is a presentation of the Oakland... That's the minutes. I'm sorry, commissioners. Item A is a presentation of the Housing Authority's quarter ending March 13, 2014 financial statements. Tonight's meeting is really devoted to the financial business of the authority. We're starting with the presentation of our current financial third quarter results, so you get a picture of how we performed this year before we get into the budget discussion next. In short order, I want to just, before I introduce them, say that I'm very pleased at our performance this year. Not only did we get saved with some receipt of when Congress took some action in January, fixing some of sequestration, but we also performed very well in some administrative savings and things that you'll see, which positioned us very well going into the next year as opposed to where we started the year. So I'd like to turn over to Janet Rice, who's Deputy Executive Director and Chief Administrative Officer, and Tracy Stabler, who is our Chief Financial Officer, to do a presentation. And this presentation has been updated from the last one you'd seen in the packet.
Good evening, commissioners. Janet Rice, Deputy Executive Director, Chief Administrative Officer. I'm going to turn this over to Tracy to walk you through, but I wanted to just publicly comment that I really appreciate the finance staff and all of the hard work that they've done. We have, over this past year, increased our efficiency in producing our financial reports on a monthly basis, and thereby we are able to more timely bring forward to you the quarterly evaluation of how the authority is doing. So with that, I will turn it over to Tracy.
Very good.
Do we want it up there? You want it on the screen? There we go.
Very good. Good evening, commissioners. My name is Tracy Stabler, Chief Financial Officer. I'd like to present to you tonight the third quarter results for fiscal 14 for the Oakland Housing Authority. This presentation is only going to be for the authority operations, so it will exclude OPI and it will exclude CAHI, the two nonprofit blended component units. The numbers are smaller than what you see in the budget, but they're the authority's numbers for the third quarter. Okay. So the big overall picture, total revenue. Through the period July 1, 2013 through March 31, 2014, was $3.8 million higher than budget, an increase of 2.1 over what was budgeted. Total expenses were $21.8 million, or 12.3% lower than what was budgeted. So the numbers will break down as follows. The revenues are comprised of tenant revenues, operating subsidies for public housing, MTW housing assistance revenues, HUD capital grants, the capital fund, and the replacement housing factor fund grants, allocated administrative overhead, which is our internal charges for the central office costs to the other departments, and then other revenue. The expenses are comprised of the admin expenses, tenant services, utilities, ordinary maintenance, protective services through our police department, housing assistance payments to our landlords and residents, and other general expenses. And then at the bottom, I wanted to point out a small change we've made from prior years in that capital expenditures now also include affiliate loan expenditures, and these are monies that we actually loan through a note to our affiliates to do their construction, their real estate development and construction. So to go into a little detail on those numbers, on the revenue lines, our biggest revenue is our MTW revenue through housing assistance. This year was 4.5, or through the third quarter, is 4.5 million higher than budgeted, 3.2%. The housing assistance was originally budgeted at 94% of utilization. Other revenues, the biggest variances on the other revenue lines are our capital fund grants, which was 5.9 million or 60% higher than originally budgeted. This is more of a timing difference than it is going receiving more than budgeted, because we actually drew the grants as we expended the money, and so we expended it a lot earlier in the first quarter and second quarter. By the end of the fiscal year, we'll probably be right on budget.
And that's based on the construction draws.
For our affiliate constructions. Mm-hmm. The other significant variance was our allocated administrative overhead, which is all of our central office costs. It's our executive office, finance, all of our administrative departments, and all the administrative pieces of our other user departments, CID and property management, et cetera. That amount was 6.9 million, 38% lower than budgeted. That's a function of the cost savings we achieved on the expense side, so we didn't have to charge the user departments as much.
So what were the savings that, so in other words, you had less expense money to allocate because it wasn't spent.
Exactly.
And what was the reason for that?
You'll see further on a lot of it was staffing vacancies that we didn't fill, or that took longer to fill than anticipated, and other administrative costs that we realized savings in.
Okay, I see. So that's people that we had expected to hire, we're trying to hire, but we were not able to fill.
Or we held off because last fall, if you remember, we went into the year with, and because as this shows, the capital fund requirements of payment, because of the way they were going out the door, we actually really held, and we held positions that we were considering filling, particularly on the administrative side and administrative offices. There are a number of positions that are vacant that we're just now starting to open up again, just to take the savings. So some of the things that were the budgeted positions that have been approved were not hired and are now recruiting for. And we did that to realize the savings, and to improve our cash flow for the year, and particularly to be able to have cash flow to meet our not only the HAP contracts but also the construction funding we had put into the deals that were coming online. And if you remember, the correction was really as a result, the funding ended up a lot brighter at the end of the year because of what Congress did in January. So had they not taken the action in January and passed an appropriations bill that reversed some of sequestration, we wouldn't be in this position. Gratefully, we've been able to now have a healthy end of the year closing, I think, where we performed well and didn't have to tap into reserves to the extent that we had anticipated because of that action by Congress in January.
Right, so we were really preparing for a worst case scenario that fortunately did not materialize.
Or that was alleviated in January. I think it would be an understatement to say it wasn't a challenging July through January.
Right.
Can I ask a question on that? Looking at the chart, it's a little confusing to me because it looks like we budgeted for a higher amount of revenue, but we actually achieved a lower amount of revenue.
And that's for the administrative overhead?
Yes.
Yeah, that's correct. Our administrative overhead revenue is monies that we charge from our central office to other OHA departments to pay us for our costs, like the finance department and the executive office, HR, communications, those departments. And so because on the expense side we saved money, we didn't have to charge them as much. So we did budget higher revenue, but we didn't have to charge that revenue because we didn't expend as much on the expense side.
Okay. So in this case, it's more like taking out a left pocket, putting in the right pocket.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And it was a good thing that we didn't charge ourselves as much. So.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank Very you. Good.
Any other questions? Okay. So on to the expense side. As I mentioned, the administrative expenses were $3.9 million, or almost 13% lower than we had originally budgeted. Tenant services are currently about 15.7% under budget. That is mainly due to timing difference also because our summer jobs and some of those programs won't kick up until the fourth quarter. So that will catch up by the end of the fiscal year. And then protective services, again, was $1.5 million or 28% lower than budgeted, mainly due to staffing vacancies and other cost-cutting or cost savings. So the administrative expenses of $3.9 million savings are mainly due to a 23% reduction in salary and benefit costs due to the staffing vacancies we had just talked about. We also had savings in our legal budgeted expenses of over 70%. And then just to note, there was an increase in the overhead allocation expenses of 40%, mainly due to just a reorganization of how we were putting the expenses before they were being charged directly to departments. And now we're putting them in the central office cost and allocating them on the same allocation plan. So our housing assistance payments is our largest expense. And then again, we also had a 12% reduction against the budget, a savings of $16.1 million. This is due to the lower voucher utilization that we implemented to address the sequestration cuts. The next slide talks about the capital and the affiliate loan expenditures that I had noted at the beginning. We are $6.8 million or 66% over budget at the third quarter. Again, that was because of our expenditures to lend the money to our affiliates for the construction happened earlier in the year that started in the first and second quarter, but we'll slow down so that by the fourth quarter it will be on budget. It will be on budget.
On budget.
By the end of the fiscal year, in the next quarter.
So it's essentially a timing issue.
Right? It's a timing issue, yes. And here's where we're at the third quarter. The sources of the capital and affiliate loan monies come from our CFP grants of almost $8.5 million.
And that's the capital fund program grants at CFP?
Yes. And then the replacement housing factor fund grants of $6.4 million. And then we used operating cash of $350,000+ for those funds were used mainly to purchase the capital assets at the bottom of the uses list, which is a business system cost and equipment and vehicle purchases. So the capital fund grant and the replacement housing factor grants were used primarily to fund our construction for Ave Vista, Lakeside, Lion Creeks, and OB's renovations.
So how does that break down between capital expenses and loans?
Right. I'm treating it for the budget purpose for this presentation, more like a governmental fund where you would have a capital outlay and you would have funding and using for finances. But at the end of the day, those expenses won't be in the CAF or our audited financial statements on the income statement. They will actually get reclassified up into notes receivable and into capital assets. I think for budget, it was important because you budget your capital on the income statement to show it here.
Okay, so these expenses then are essentially going to become investments?
Yes.
So they will be capitalized when that happens?
Yes, they will get capitalized at the end of the year.
Now, I'm curious about this interim process here. So they're only temporarily expenses.
Right. They're actually capital expenses. There are notes receivable, but if you can see on the line of the quarterly summary report itself, the excess of revenue over expenses of $2.4 million to the budget is literally where the financial statements end, and then we actually put the line at the bottom to show you the capital because it is such a large expenditure. And particularly for the affiliate loans, if we're showing revenue coming in because we're pulling it, it kind of overinflates the revenue side if you're not going to see the capital expenditure.
And the next page is again a summary of that report so that you can see it. Because if we did not include those capital expenditures, then you would think we have all this revenue just as excess, and we don't. Because you can only draw the capital fund or the replacement housing factor funds if you have actual expenditures to support them. So you can't draw that money until you have the documents to support, which is invoices from your contractors.
Okay, you have to draw and expend within 30
days. I guess I understand. I mean, normally in accounting, I mean, if you have an asset of cash and you turn that into an asset of whatever that's not cash, mm-hmm. well, you're going to have an expense from cash, right? And then you're going to have, and then you're going to create the asset, right?
Right. You reclass it at the end of the fiscal year to a capitalized asset if you're finished with the project or it's in construction in progress. So that happens at the end of the fiscal year.
Okay, I understand. So in other words, it's because it's in process, in construction, that's why it's not capitalized at this point. So it's not like we're just suddenly capitalizing it because it's the end of the year.
That's correct.
Okay, I got it.
Okay,
right.
Very good.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. I think you guys kind of left me for a minute, so I'm going to ask you. I think the answer was in the previous conversation we just had, but could you explain the last three lines again, even if you have to repeat what you just said, the last three lines on the summary report?
On the summary sheet?
Because mm-hmm. of the differences?
Okay. So the last line, the third from the bottom, mm-hmm. okay, the $2.4 million is actually operating expenses. That's the amount of money that you would have left if you only counted just the operating expenses. The second line represents the capital expenditures that we have used capital money for that will be capitalized at the end of the year. So those dollars are put into the projects that were listed on the sheet before.
That's the second to the bottom line where it says capital and affiliate mm-hmm. loan expenditures, $10,015,000. That's what she's talking about, not excess revenue over expenses. That's just a calculation line.
Correct. Right. Correct.
And then
the last line represents if you take the $2 million minus you have $10 million in capitalized expenditures, that's where you come up with your $7.9 million deficit.
Okay. And then we move forward into the year-to-date.
And that's the year-to-date budget. Now let's talk about the year-to-date actual.
Right.
And that's the $12,682,000 positive.
And that's positive because we received, if you go up to the top, where you see the line where it says HUD grants,
okay.
and you also see the housing assistance revenue up there, because remember, that's higher than we anticipated. And so those primary dollars are what end up offsetting because we've got reductions in the expenditure lines, correct, below? And so that's why you have $182 million in revenue and you have $154 in expenses. So now that leaves you with $27 million, $27.9 million
okay.
of extra revenue.
Okay.
Now, because you also have capital expenditures of $15 million, you deduct that from the $27 million to come up with an overall balance year to date of $12
million.
Mm-hmm. And again, that's year to date, so that's March 31st, 2014,
March 31st.
Not this quarter. We have some major expenditures that are going to also occur this quarter, so this isn't going to be the year-end amount that we walk away with. We have several large checks to write for Ave Vista and Lakeside Senior, and those have not hit. We're going to try and catch back up with our unfunded liability for post-retirement medical benefits that we did not pay last year as well. So we're going to do those catch-ups before the end of this fiscal year. So we're not going to end the fiscal year with $12 million, you know, ahead, it'll be significantly less than that. Yeah.
This covers 9 months of the fiscal year.
So by in 3 more months, we will have a better picture because everything will flesh out.
That is correct.
It's important to note. I mean, I really want to congratulate the staff and for their work in doing it. That at this point in the quarter, we thought we would be $7.9 million in deficit. We got a huge bonus with the increase in the HAP, a huge bonus with replacement housing factor funds coming online and being available under the MTW assistance reserve line and the HUD grant line. And that really helped, but also $3.9 million worth of savings within the agency this year for, you know, holding, not hiring when we needed positions and really trying to have discipline. And I think that that has resulted in a lot better picture than I would have thought prior to January.
Let's not call it a bonus, though. I'm sure it's money that.
Well, it's money that it isn't. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
It's still being funded at a fraction of the 100% HUD amount. So it's just an improvement over the dire condition of the fall.
Commissioner Pitts.
So I concur with Executive Director Johnson. You guys have done an excellent job on this presentation. I am wondering on the capital and affiliate loan expenditures side, if some of those expenditures that we're talking about upcoming worked their way in. I'm wondering where the $6.8 million is versus the $4.9 million in the year-to-date variance in that, and in the overall summary.
Where
is the $6.8 million coming in? So if you look at the quarterly summary and the capital and affiliate loan expenditures, you have a $4.9 million deficit there.
Uh-huh.
And then on the capital expenditures, slide 9, capital and affiliate loan expenditures are $6.8 million, or 66% over budget. I'm wondering where that $6.8 million is shown. And is that, am I making sense?
Yes. Hold on one second.
No, I'm not. So, where is this from?
So you're
okay, so you're looking at the year-to-date variance.
On the, right? Capital and affiliate
the
loan
year-to-date
expenditures.
Variance of
so you're looking at slide number 5?
I'm looking at, or 11, either
okay.
one.
Well, slide number 5 is the revenue side of it?
Right, no, I'm looking at slide number 9.
Mm-hmm. Right.
At the $6.8 million over budget for capital and loan.
Oh, I see.
And then I'm also looking at the quarterly summary report, which is number 11, or there's one earlier that's the same exact
slide. So what it says, the capital and affiliate loan expenditures are 6.8 or 66% over budget for this period through March 30th?
Right.
Yeah.
And what we did is have a front load of a lot of expenditures in the fall. And what this does is calculate based on if everything was spent the same throughout the quarters.
But to answer your question, I think that's a typo. I believe that the quarterly summary report is to correct the 4.9.
So this one should be 4.9 and 47.3%.
Yes. That would make sense.
Yes. Okay, well, yeah, that was because I'm going through looking for where we're 66% over to figure out which line we're dealing with.
And quarterly, but you know, whenever they do quarterly reports, and this since, you know, this is for all the future quarterly financials, is they can really, when you do the percentage off the variance, we tend to look at those that are excessive more than plus or minus 10%. So you get your variance report, if it's plus or minus, look for something. The thing that is really skewing to me and always has been about them, if you don't know the nuts and bolts of the agency, it could be you're budgeting $170,000 for a summer youth enrichment program that we do with Youth Uprising to put 70 kids through something, and that's not going to hit until June. But every quarter, it's going to say your variance is off because you're not spending regularly. Because what the variance percentages try to tell you is one quarter, or to go progressively. First quarter, they say everything's spent, a quarter of the funding, this should be spent. At December 31st, 50% should be spent, and then three quarters at March 31st. And that's not the way budgets are often spent. Works okay with staff, works okay with benefits, and works okay with utilities. But when you get into really the things that we do, there's so many that are targeted different period of the years that the percentage can be very misleading in different ways. That's what I thought you were getting at with your question, is that what ended up happening with our development activities in the fall, when we were actually had the least amount of liquidity, is when all of our development projects started going online, and we had to do the we were starting to fund the construction side of it out of our gap funds, and it was really that was what happened in essence. And by the end of the fiscal year is what you're always getting for. Are you on pace to expend it, or are you over expended in that item by the end of the fiscal year? Yes.
On that note, I think it would be helpful, actually, to have a column that was year-to-date total. Oh, you do, the year-to-date budget total, mm-hmm. but actually the total budget for the whole year mm-hmm. instead of to-date. Because then we could actually evaluate if we are completely
that.
Over or if some things are front-loaded. I sit on the board for a school, which mm-hmm. has the same mm-hmm. sorts of issues because summertime we have no staff and right. no mm-hmm. students. So we've... Okay. But yeah, that would be
We include that for ourselves. We just simplified it for this presentation. We'll include that in the regular.
That report. Would be great. Okay, thank you.
Commissioner May.
So in accordance with that, the 66% over is actually 47.3?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Now that has actually prompted a question in my mind. So we have different classes of expenses. For example, if we have salaries, for example, I mean, are pretty regular. You know, you're paying people every month. However, what you're doing with real estate projects or something like Eric just mentioned, the summer jobs program, you have these things that occur that are seasonal. Are we just straight lining those through the year, or are we making an attempt to forecast when those expenditures are going to hit when we put the budget together for the year?
We don't project in the budget when they're going to hit, but the only way to track that and the way you do it is you do a variance report, and then the staff fills in plus or minus 10%. They get a list. You have them report in a column saying why you're overpacing or underpacing, because what you're really talking about is pacing on your expenditures.
That's
a lot of minutia.
The one thing we do is we do report salary and related benefits on our pay of 26 periods. So instead of it being a monthly amount, mm-hmm. we annualize it so that we didn't want the user departments to say, you know, until that third paycheck shows up in the month of March, they didn't have all this extra budget for salaries. So we actually match it to the pay period, but everything else is 1/12. The problem with, like, the youth jobs is that they actually incur the expense almost ratably also. It's just a matter of when the billing comes in. But, you know, it's hard to predict, you know, if they're going to, you know, bill us up front for, you know, one quarter of the contract in the first quarter or not. It's really up to the vendor on how they expend it.
I see. So what you're saying, really, or what I think I'm hearing, is that there are sufficient unknowns regarding the calendarization of when some of these expenses are going to hit that it's just not reasonable to try to forecast that
right.
when the budget is prepared. I mean,
correct.
You do have some window of some time frame window of where they're going to hit, but it can be larger than one might think.
Yes, yes. If you look on slide number 10, which is the capital loan expenditure, on the uses side, like the $10.7 million that was used to fund the construction for Lion Creek 5, that essentially hit in the first quarter of the fiscal year because that was where they were at in their construction. But the Ave Vista, it took longer because they had more paperwork and more closing, more settlement. Before they were actually able to break ground. So we had no way of judging back when the budget was developed at what point they would finish with the legalities and actually start the construction. So that actually didn't happen until actually closer to the second and the third quarter.
And I would also add that currently the systems that we have don't have adequate capacity for forecasting. So typically you'd have a business system tool that you'd be able to you know, basically change or modify according to your knowns and unknowns. And right now, for the most part, our budget is compiled based on an Excel spreadsheet. So it's not like you have a business system where you could plug in a number and then change the modeling of that particular line item. So our system doesn't lend itself to forecasting in an efficient way. It would be really labor intensive to be able to do it based on what we know now. There are some instances where we don't know, but then where we can.
So you're saying that when you're doing your forecasting in Excel, that if you were to do something If you were to forecast cash flows or expenditure hits that were nonlinear, that would involve a lot of additional manual work, and what you're saying is that's really not feasible, but that should be feasible when our new system is up and running. Is that
right?
Is that
right? Fair? We would hope that we're going to look at the budget module, which a budget module should have that ability to not only capture current expenditures but also forecast as well. And this system does have the capability of doing that.
Because I would think that when you have lump sum payments occurring at given points during the mm-hmm. year, I mean, I don't know, maybe there's some way to model that, but whenever I've done that, I just write the numbers in. You know, I mean, because it's like, oh, that's going to land in, that's
right.
going to land in May.
Right.
Okay, so it'll be sometime in that quarter, so mm-hmm. put the number in.
Right.
Okay, that's fine, that's good. I understand. Thank you. Oh, yes, Commissioner Hurd has a question. Okay.
This question may have already been answered, but I was looking at the excess revenue over projected expenses. Mm-hmm. And how exactly is that calculated?
So for year-to-date actual, the year-to-date actual column in the summary?
Yes.
Okay, so that is basically taking the total revenue of $182 million. It is then taking the total expenses of $154 million, and then you get your $27.9 million excess amount,
yeah.
And then we take out the $15 million in capital expenditures,
okay.
And that is how you get to the bottom line, $12.6 million, and that's only for 9 months of the fiscal year.
Okay.
So there's still three more months, one more quarter, that we have to see those expenses. And typically it's one more quarter, but we won't actually get financial statements completed until the closing is usually mid-July, because that's year-end closing. So we probably won't see anything in aggregated form until probably August.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then one more question.
Yeah.
Just one more question, I'm sorry. The fees earned, that's a combination of what exactly?
The fees earned, we actually changed in a later slide to say allocated administrative overhead. And
okay.
What those are the internal charges we charge the other departments for our administrative costs.
Okay. Admin costs. Thank you, Chair.
Commissioner Montgomery.
Yeah, I just want, our fiscal year ends in July.
June 30.
Okay, so that would be another, this is a quarterly report, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that would be another report in?
A final year-end report. Which
yeah, we'll do the year. Probably not until, because we close the books and we have the audit, so it usually isn't in until September. I don't know when we'll.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
and then they'll tell how we ended the year.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's
mm-hmm.
what I. So this is just mm-hmm. keeping us abreast of quarterly what you know,
right.
what's.
Right. What
yeah.
we've done for
right.
the first 9 months of the fiscal year.
Of the fiscal year. Okay, I understand that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Very good. Any other questions?
One more question. Excess revenue over expenses.
I just asked that.
I know.
Okay.
You didn't ask about the percentage variance.
Oh, it's 35.
I think it's just the mathematical function because it was a $2 million versus $27 million.
Yeah, see,
so because
it's the base.
A lot of our, it was also a bigger increase in the capital and loan of expenditures, which kind of narrows that variance down. So it truly is a thousand, you know, because the $27 million is, you know, 10 times bigger than the $2
million.
So, I mean, when you start looking at the variances, those kind of anomalies happen.
Yeah. I just want to put a period there somewhere so everybody doesn't look at it.
No, it's right. I asked no, about it, too, when I first saw it. I'm like, how's it present? You know, run my calculator. No, it is correct.
Okay.
Well, that is indeed an impressive number.
I'd love to take credit, but I think it was an authority-wide effort.
All right. And this is just receive and file.
And that concludes our presentation on the quarterly financials. I'm going to now turn this over to Tracy and Domenica, and they are going to walk you through the budget.
Thank you.
Item B. Oh, yes. Move. Okay, we're finished. Okay, yeah. Item A is now completed. Moving on to item B.
And item B is a presentation of the Housing Authority's, or consideration of resolution approving the Oakland Housing Authority's comprehensive budget, public housing program, AMP budgets, and staffing plan for fiscal year ending June 30th, 2015, and HUD certification. And you're looking at an old draft, so it should say 2015 on the monitor, but it's not. So we're going to start with just a presentation. Again, I'd like to introduce not only Tracy Stabler, our Chief Financial Officer, who's joined by our Director of Planning, Implementation, and Compliance, Domenica Henderson. Take it over. There we go.
Okay. Good. Good evening, Commissioners. My name is Domenica, and I will walk you through the first half of the presentation. We'll just give you a little bit of background on how the budget was developed, and then Tracy will take it away after that to go through the details of the budget with you. So just to begin, this year, the House and the President have released their proposed budgets. We're still waiting on some action in part of Congress, but what I wanted to present to you with this slide is the proposed budgets against the fiscal year 2014 enacted levels. As you can see in the first column, there are both the levels of funding and then the proration percentage that was imposed by Congress. And so for the public housing operating funds, you'll see a $4.4 billion appropriation, which is an 86% proration from the year that it was at 100%. So
that's actually of 100, if it were 100% of the money that was entitled to a housing authority, and this gets back to Commissioner Castillo's point of what I said, right, that we're only getting 86% of the capital fund. So rather than get a dollar, we're getting 86 cents on the dollar.
And so for almost, for basically the seventh year in a row, we've been prorated in some of the different funds. And so you'll see these proration numbers throughout. The capital fund doesn't necessarily receive a proration, but it is funded by a formula that has also been cut over the past several years. So it doesn't have a proration amount, but this $1.75 billion that was funded, and you'll see in some other slides, as it affects the Oakland Housing Authority, has been cut over the past years and depends on the, is impacted by some disposition, but that fund is not specifically prorated like the voucher or admin fee funds, as you can see below. And so for the voucher renewals, for the HAP, basically, it's at 97% proration, and then the admin fee is at 73%.
I would just add on our prorations before we go on. These are conservative, again. We like to budget our revenue. These are what we think we're going to get from HUD. Mm-hmm. We don't know what we're going to get. We will not know until this fall. There is discussions on the HUD, on the House side, and they're looking at their language. They can pass something. That doesn't mean it'll ever get enacted. The President submitted theirs, then last the Senate gets a crack at it. The best kind of school of thought right now is that we'll probably get a continuing resolution from the deal that was struck in January. And if we get that, it'll be sometime in September or October. It could be that they do a short-term funding and maybe end there. But they're moving forward as though they're going to do an appropriations, although people tell me on the side that they really think it'll be a continuing resolution during an election year. Okay, go on.
Okay, and so just the way we built the budget is based on these funding levels, and so you'll see there are some similarities.
So just to make sure that I understand the previous slide, when I look at voucher renewals and I see the 97% number, does that mean that we are allotted, I mean, that we're funded to 97% of our voucher authorization? Is that what that means? So that we really, that if we were to go to 100, it would be coming out of our, we would have to find extra money to be able to do that? Is that, my interpretation right?
No, it's really just the amount, it's the funding amount for housing assistance payments. Instead of funding us at 100%, they usually fund us pretty high on the Section 8 side. The one exception was sequestration, 2012 and last in 2013, where they went down lower than 97%. The Section 8 program up until that time had always been pretty sacrosanct. They always preserved the funding. We're projecting 97% funding. Now, remember, we are an MTW agency, so that money goes into the MTW pot along with the other funding. We're not projecting higher. So if you look at the president's proposal, they're doing, you know, $18.007 billion as opposed to $17.3 and a higher proration. If you look at the House, right, when we last knew, they were at 17. You're not sure where they're going to end. We want to project something that we think is not going to be unreasonable by the time they make their decision. So we funded expecting not, we may improve over the year like we did last year. We're underestimating, I think, our half on this, maybe by a percentage or two. So we wanted to run the numbers this way because I would rather outperform our deficit at the end of this fiscal year than under. And this is how we go about actually making sure that we're always within budget. We're conservative on estimating what we think HUD will give us, and we never know. There's never going to be a year where everyone is sitting here and we know what HUD is going to give us that year. It's always basing it on what you think they're going to do. Because we're not having to cut, because we're not under that kind of conditions, we want to budget our revenue from HUD in what we think is a realistic number on the low end so that we can make sure we don't run out of money mid-year and we can service the families we're planning to serve. And when we get to the next slide, you're going to see why this was important to do it this way.
Let me maybe rephrase my question. So the 97% proration, how does that affect our, I mean, what impact does that have on our ability to serve families?
What usually happens in a non-MTW agency is they get a certain dollar amount for HAP, and they're told you can't exceed this number of people. So if you get to zero where you have no HAP money left and you're going to end vouchers, then you can go apply to HUD and say, I need more money. And that happened last year to a lot of housing authorities. But what usually happens is at the end of the year, you do a year-end reconciliation with HUD. They look at what your actual housing assistance payments were. This isn't the admin fee, just the rent assistance. And they take everything back you haven't expended. Yeah. And with us, they don't do that. Because we're MTW, we don't get the year-end. We have MTW funds, and they don't get the year-end reconciliation. That's the big bonus in terms of how our funds move in an MTW agency that is different than a regular housing authority, that year-end reconciliation. But most housing authorities won't expend all their HAP funds to serve their maximum number of families. There'll be a year-end reconciliation. So when Congress is doing their budget, think, we can go down to 98, 97, and that's all doable. So we're budgeting at 97. We're not sure where they're going to come out this year. If they funded it 100%, it's great. But right now we think this is a fairly reasonable projection to make. The administrative fee we're funding at 73% because that has been taken the hardest hit. It was in the high 60s last year. In January, they increased it to 73-74%. So we're going with last January's, betting on a continuing resolution. And this becomes real important for the next slide because the first one I get to read, and then you can do the rest.
Okay.
OHA will continue funding programs at all the current level, and we seek to increase MTW voucher lease-up rate from 94% to a full 100% by the end during this fiscal year. So we're going to go back to serving more families, and we're going to go back to serving more families than HUD gives us money for by using our efficiencies to do that. And it was the biggest decision, and I think we delayed preparing all this to get to this decision, and we actually only came up with it realized we could make it all work late last week, so we're busy retweaking the budget to see what it cost us, to make sure we could do it, because our mission is to try and be at 100-102%, and we haven't been because of sequestration. Can we make this work given our current funding scenario? And that's how we spent last week. And that was kind of our last-minute push, is to really be able to bring to you today a budget that takes us back up to 100% lease up. And I am proud to say that we're gonna run with it. Right, Michelle? Go on. You can.
Okay, so with the – you'll see with the fiscal year 2015 budget, as we funded – using the proration levels from 2014, we used a lot of the same guiding principles for other areas of the budget as well. And so the 2014 budget reflects very similar ideals as, I'm sorry, the 2015 budget reflects similar ideals as what we proposed last year. So we will continue investment in the new business system, move forward with this budget to complete the Webster Street administrative office renovations. We'll fully fund our project-based voucher commitments that are coming online during this fiscal year. And this budget also proposes to maintain police department services, the staffing levels, and family and community partnerships initiatives as well. So this slide gives a little bit of a history of our public housing operating subsidy that we've received. As you can see, it has decreased over time, the amount that we receive, and that obviously is impacted by the proration levels. And so we have shown you the past four years, just to give you an idea of what we propose for this moving into this new budget. And so the 2014 is the number that we use to design this current 15 budget.
And you can see the trend for public housing. This is public housing operating. It's what they give us to help pay for the rents for the residents living in public housing. And this, if this were to go on to the left and started in about 1982 to now, you would see a continual decline in public housing funding with one exception year, and that was the first year of the Obama administration. They did 100% funding. It was the only time in my 25 years that I know they have ever funded public housing at 100%. What Congress knows is that if they don't give us enough money, we're not going to take the unit offline and we'll somehow make it work. Now, that's been true for a lot of years, but I would tell you more and more throughout the country, the struggling housing authorities are really having serious issues with it. Our issues were related mostly to our scattered sites where we weren't rehabbing them and putting them online in a quality way, and now we're going through this massive effort to get that done. And that's as a result of the fact that every year you got less money. So it's a trend line if you look from 7 down to, you know, over 4 years, from 7 down to just over 6, down to 5.8 for 2014. And that looks a little off on the graph. But the numbers, if you look at them, are just every year. And that's, I think, a trend that's going to continue. And the current Secretary of HUD, Sean Donovan, has said publicly and will say privately many times that he just decided public housing was the platform everybody hated and everyone had to move on to the Section 8 program because that was the one people supported. And that was the impetus to do RAD, the rental assistant demonstration, where you're moving those public housing units that can cash flow onto this new Section 8-like program. It isn't really a full-funded Section 8 program.
Okay, and so that was for our public housing units that are all part of the MTW program. And I did want to describe for you a little bit the asset repositioning fee, because you may have seen it on past year's budgets, but it won't be reflected anymore. The asset repositioning fee is funding that is a phased-down funding that the authority receives based on the number of units that are disposed of. And so you'll see a large allocation over the past. It's 3 years, and so that's why the zero number shows up in 2013, because that number is funded from the 2010 disposition of the scattered sites.
So this money is actually money that helped us with OP for the first years that we put into OP. And if you can see, it's about $20 million.
Right.
And it's so it no longer exists because we've run the time clock for the asset repositioning fee.
Yeah.
And so then we're moving on to the capital fund program. And I wanted to also just point out that in 2010, we received $8 million. We then disposed of the scattered sites, and so the number decreases significantly over the next several years. And so this year, our capital fund allocation is $2.7 million. And the chart looks a little bit almost inverse, I guess, as compared to the next one, the replacement housing factor grant, which is essentially like the capital fund, utilized like the capital fund dollars, in that it was in 2010, there was a few $392,000, I think, for the Tasa Faranga disposition.
Yeah.
Right. And then after the scattered site disposition, that replacement housing factor funds increased. And so those funds are 10 years in two increments, so 2 5-year increments. And so you see the 11 to 14 is for the first increment of the scattered site disposition. Some of Tasa Faranga might still be in there as well.
I think in 2011 it had both, and then it went down to just the scattered sites. And these are first increment replacement housing factor funds.
Right.
And this is what we decided in the retreat, how we were going to spend, which it allowed us to do what we're currently developing. And as you can see, the money's going out the door as quickly as we bring it in.
Mm-hmm.
So there's usually you have 24 months to obligate, 24 months to expend. We are actually, as soon as it's available, drawing it down and putting it into our development pipeline because we have one, which is nice. The only other thing I want to point out is replacement housing factor funds, unlike the capital fund, are not MTW dollars. They have to be accounted for separately and can only be used for development activities. We're able to use it to develop project-based Section 8 under a special authority from HUD. The capital fund grant is block granted into the MTW. And in our line items, you're going to see capital fund, and actually it's the combined slides of both of these, I believe, because
mm-hmm.
the replacement housing factor fund is part of the capital fund, but you can't use MTW fungibility with the money. It has to be segregated.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. A question on this. Is the replacement housing factor grant program replacing the capital fund?
No.
Which
so you have the
out?
Capital fund. The capital
oh.
fund is going is underfunded, and if you look at the variations, it changes every year based on the proration. Replacement housing factor funds are funds you get when you dispose of public housing. So when we went through the disposition process and converted them to project-based Section 8, so we got rid of the public housing, we were able to also get the two back. Can you go back two slides?
Two back. Yeah, sure.
So we got asset repositioning fee, which helped with the transition from public housing to project-based Section 8 in our case, and then two forward. And the replacement housing factor funds, which come in two increments. The first increment is spent. We have one more left. And then if we meet all the compliance with the first one, because we're still under the old rules, this has changed.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't do this anymore. There's a new rule. And I can tell you about that when we meet, I think, next week. But the old rules, we're subject to, and we actually fought with HUD to change the date on the notice and won so that we could preserve the second increment funding for the board, and that'll be five more years of funding. The only difference in the five more years, we still get the same percentage, but we have a different obligation in terms of how we leverage. But because Phil does such a great job, as he's working hard, at leveraging, we've exceeded any leveraging requirements on the entire replacement housing factor fund, so we don't have any issues with that. But what HUD allows you with the first increment is you could spend 100% just building your own public housing. You don't have to come in and do any tax credits or bring bonds in or go for city money or any of that. But as you know, we always do that. So our leverage is fine, and we'll be having a discussion about what to do for the next 5 years with that pipeline before the end of the year.
Okay. So now we get into the larger pot, the Housing Choice Voucher Subsidy. You see over time we have received in 2012, $184 million, in 2013, $187 million, and then in 2014, $184 million. This number includes, these numbers include the MTW vouchers and also the Mod Rehab Mainstream and VASH vouchers as well, which are not part of the MTW program but are part of the Housing Choice Voucher portfolio. And those cover, at this point, 13,574 vouchers. And so as part of that entire 13,000-plus number, we have project-based vouchers included in that number. And so for fiscal year 2015, we proposed that 317 new project-based units will come online, and then in fiscal 16, we also just kind of identified three sites that are approved by that you have previously approved in under different meetings, but have not yet entered into contract with the Housing Authority and the partner. So those are still pending, but for fiscal year 2015, we proposed that 317 units will be coming online, and this is just the lease-up schedule of when we expect those units to actually lease up. And so you'll see that 317 that is in that fiscal year 2015 total will be down here in the new external PBV number for the end of fiscal year 2015. And so I'll walk you through this chart just to make sure that it's clear. At the end of 2013, we reported in our MTW report that we had 324 new project-based voucher units come online for a total of 1,256 total project-based vouchers that in our entire portfolio. And then we had 11,000 plus tenant-based vouchers, which adds up to the 12,417 vouchers at a 97.9% utilization rate. And so what this utilization rate is important because before in the first or second slide, I believe we said we want to increase from 94% up to 100%. And so for fiscal year end 2014, we propose or we expect that we'll have 76 external units come online. We've had some additional PBV units come online through the scattered site conversion process to have a total of 1,618 total project-based vouchers for the end of this fiscal year. And then that would get us to roughly 10,675 tenant-based vouchers, and our total pool, we're serving at a 96% utilization rate. So we're still not at 100, but hopefully through the end of the fiscal year, we'll get up a little bit from that 94% that we reported earlier to 96%. And then
and
for
that's this fiscal year.
That's this fiscal year, right. Okay. So
we're going to move then from, we're currently at 94, right?
We're about 95, actually.
Okay. So by the end of this year, we'll be at 96.
We're projecting 96 for the end of this year.
So we're going to have a little bit of growth.
Yeah.
And then next year, okay, yeah. Okay, good, I get it.
Okay. And then for 2015, we'll have that 317 units come online from our external partners. We'll have about 100 more through our scattered site conversion for a total of 2,035 units in our project-based portfolio, and then we have 10,770 that we project as tenant-based vouchers, which would get us to the 100% utilization rate, and which would be 12,805. So the 12,805 is a number that will be our total pool that we expect to have for our Housing Choice Voucher program.
And those are the MTW Housing Choice Voucher.
Yes, the MTW programs, vouchers.
Not the non-MTW ones,
right.
They're separate.
Yes. Why are we under for 2014 versus 2013? In other words, it's like 98% for 2013, and we're going to end up at 96% at 2014.
That was a result of the sequestration, and during the budget process of 14, the decision was made to drop the utilization to counter the budget cuts that we expected to receive.
Yes, sequestration occurred and they passed it in March of 2013. So we did not, we quit issuing vouchers off the tenant voucher list.
I want to ask the last question.
Yeah.
It's going to be embarrassing. Okay. No, it's all good.
Did you agree? Okay. Okay. Commissioner Castillo?
So, I'm trying to formulate maybe two different questions. By the end of 2015, we hope to be at 100%.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Will it take us that long to get to 100%?
No,
I presume no.
We're hoping in the fall, but it depends how quickly people do lease up and how quickly we can gear up to get the vouchers back out there. But I would look toward the mid-year of hopefully hitting 100%. The question also becomes, when are the project-based units going to be available for occupancy past HQS and get a voucher placed on them? What is their construction schedule? Are there delays? Now, remember, some of these are our own construction projects, but they're also ones we don't control and that are we just awarded vouchers. So it's kind of a guesstimate and in terms of how you balance the two, and that's part of what Michelle has to do, Hassan, our director of leased housing, has to do, is balance when those project-based vouchers are going to come off, come back online, so that we make sure that we don't exceed what we have, but also get as many tenant-based vouchers out there as we possibly can for any time. What this will show you, I think the next two slides, is kind of the balancing act. You want to show the next two?
Sure.
Let me just clarify what you just said, Director, because I think my question is, will we be pulling from finally our 2011
yes.
folks that have been waiting for so long,
yeah.
and also from our scattered sites waiting list.
Scattered
so
sites,
that's the balancing
scattered sites have always
that
been
we're
served.
Talking about?
No, scattered sites have always been served through the year because they're project-based Section 8. So the one way during the past year where we have been issuing tenant-based vouchers is the project-based Section 8 program has been serving people, and that includes our scattered sites, which are under OPI. The balance is this slide, which shows our tenant-based vouchers, the voucher that goes with the tenant that are used in the private market, not project-based to a unit. And what Michelle has to do is balance the tenant-based, balance the tenant-based to the project-based to reach 100%. So if you have 8% project-based, then you want to have 92% tenant-based. If you suddenly go up in your project-based and you have 12%, then you want to have 88% on your project base to stay at 100. I would prefer we get to 102. We can't really do it this year, but I am rolling the dice on 100, and the Congress will keep us going. And we may have to make adjustments to that if they don't. But this will show you the tenant. And if you look at the two lines and the middle section, that's this year. So if you look at the left line, left of it, the line you'll see, that was last year. You can see the steady decline that happens from attrition, people who exit the program, and you're going down, and so we get down to the number, and then if you look at the end of this fiscal year and starting next, we think we'll have a little bit of down, but then we'll start climbing, and the climbing is both us issuing the next project-based vouchers, but in this case, issuing tenant-based vouchers. So what Michelle's done is map out a roadmap to stay at 100%, and that's getting us leased up to 100% by the end of this year, this calendar year, and you can see the peak, and then you can see it start going down, and you see that next line on the slide? That next line's the end of this next fiscal year, and then you get into 2016, because she's mapping out for the next 2 years what we're doing, and you'll see a gradual decline again of tenant-based vouchers. We're going to start serving people again, because if there's attrition, we'll pull people in, and then we're going to do the lease up this next 6 months. And that's, but the decline you're seeing is because more project-based vouchers are coming online, which is the next slide. Do you want to show them?
Sure.
So here's what we're doing with project-based vouchers. So you start to the left of the line was last year, the middle is this year, and to the right of the line is next year's projected. And so you can see there's an ever-increasing number of units that have been project-based because it's all the same pool. Whether we call them project-based or tenant-based, they all need to equal 100% together. So I hope that clarifies it. Okay.
Commissioner Pitt, you have a question, right?
Yeah. I'm actually back on slide 8 or page 8, looking at the voucher count, and I think
I understand that this voucher count has both MTW vouchers, which is your project-based and your tenant-based, as mm-hmm. well as Mod Rehab, Mainstream, and VASH
right.
yeah. vouchers in it.
Right.
So that is what I'm assuming accounts for the differences on page
yes.
10 between
mm-hmm.
the
absolutely
amounts
correct.
There. So I think it would be useful overall for us to see all of those on slide 10 so we could see the total lease up.
Okay, you mean the non-MTW vouchers?
The non-MTW vouchers also, because
yeah.
that plays a piece of this whole
it
puzzle.
Does to an extent, except we can't mm-hmm. be fungible with those.
Okay.
We need to be 100% lease up on them.
So
and
they have
fight.
Their own.
They have their okay. own, and they're monitored and kept mm-hmm. separate because they don't impact our, we can't control the lease up on that.
Okay.
We want to be at 100%, and that's it. That's under the regular rules.
So we are at 100% on those.
All but VASH, I think.
Currently.
It depends when they come on. She can, you want to come up and answer where we are on them?
Okay.
We got, for example, this year we got new VASH in November, so we had a series of other VASH vouchers. We've been working with the VA to try and get people through that. It's can be hard.
A process.
Yeah.
Good evening, Commissioners. Michelle Hassan, Director of Leased Housing. So our non-MTW vouchers are our Mainstream, VASH, and what are called NED vouchers. And currently...
NED, non-elderly
disabled. Non-elderly disabled. Family unification. So currently, we're not at 100% for those vouchers. We've been given authorization by Eric to actually lease those up to 100. So we have 175 Mainstream, 85 non-elderly disabled, 260 VASH, and about 75 FUP, which are the family reunification. Those vouchers are separately funded, and they actually are not MTW.
So we don't gain by not being at 100%, basically.
Right.
Yeah, and we're currently trying. You know, we've been trying to get the lease up with Vash for some time. It's a time.
We're at about a 190 leased now.
And out of a how many? What's the
260.
So there's still a significant number of Vash vouchers, which means that no one really. And we've been serving them regularly. The other efforts are not as large.
Okay. So that's good to know.
Yeah, I agree. And we're doing everything we can on our end, I assure you, to try and move them quickly and get them housed.
And we have those families actually coming in June for the mainstream and the non-elderly disabled. We've pulled 320 people, and they're coming in for their appointments next month, so that's exciting. They came from the HCV 2011 list.
Right. Okay, perfect. So can I keep going with my question? Mm-hmm. So the subsidy line in slide 8 here, is that's the subsidy then for all the vouchers, the 184
yes.
million? And what is controlling the subsidy account? Is that due once again to fiscal budgeting at the federal level?
Yeah, that's the HAP mm-hmm. account. So yeah. that's the housing assistance payment account, and that's okay. where they prorate it.
They prorated it down. Yeah. So that is actually what we got for 2014.
Yeah, we're carrying it forward. There was a little upward in 2013 mm-hmm. Of a couple of million, but it won't be. But we're going with the 184 this year. Yeah,
and that's what we're projecting for
yes,
2015.
That's
also.
For this one. Yes, that's well. The okay. 2014 money becomes 2015 money because we lag mm-hmm. behind. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Excellent. All right. Thank you. I just wanted to understand that all.
And I just wanted to point out one thing. I probably will be back before you sometime soon to give a report on the MTW report. And so I want to make sure that it's clear that the percentages of utilization are different than the baseline. You may hear me say at some point that we're 100% of our baseline. We're always above 100% of our baseline. So just because it says 96% utilization for our vouchers doesn't mean that we are below that 100% baseline of the number of families that we serve. We still make up that number through the non-traditional programs that we operate. But I just want to make sure that that's clear because that's really important for us in order to maintain compliance with HUD and our MTW agreement.
And those are things like the sponsor-based program that
right.
we do with the city.
And the tax credit units.
And the tax credit units that we built that don't have other assistance on them. Yeah.
Okay, so I think we've gone through these couple slot. Oh, sure.
Yeah, just a follow-up. Did the subsidy amount per unit
subsidy
decrease in 2014?
Well, the subsidy amount per unit stays the same. What they do is prorate the amount.
The
and so we're projecting the proration based, I think, what was it, 97%? I think the first slide.
97%.
So for 2015's Housing Authority budget, we're projecting the 184, not the 187 that you see that was actually from 2013's federal budget. But remember, we lag a year behind because the federal budget in 2014 becomes our 2015
right.
revenue.
Yeah. Well, the reason why I'm asking is because I see the increased number of units, but the
mm-hmm.
decreased amounts of subsidy.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And that increase in the number of units, too, is also can be attributed to some mod rehab units that may convert from mod rehab to project-based assistance or
yeah.
tenant protection vouchers.
Some of it were the additional Vash vouchers that we got
right.
in the middle of the year that weren't projected in last year's budget, but we got during this fiscal year. But the other point is well taken, is that what we're doing is looking at our total voucher count, and that's the total that we get of all our programs together
mm-hmm.
combined, but the voucher count really consists of the MTW tenant-based vouchers plus the non-vouchers. And because Vash has been growing every year, we've gotten more voucher counts. Unfortunately, it hasn't equated to more money because they've overall prorated it down for the first time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now that makes sense. One more question. You have often said we hope that we're going to get more in the middle of the year. Is that the middle of the fiscal year or the middle of the calendar year?
Back in the day, it used to be they would fund us at a level, and then you would get, during the course of the year, you would get friendly amendments to bills that would increase funding for our programs. And that was its own challenge because you were thinking, okay, what would they put forth during the year to increase this otherwise low proration to bail us out of some issues during appropriations? That hasn't gone on for now several of the past, at least since 2000, probably 11, at all. It's been just the cut. So there hasn't been an effort to go back in mid-year. Last year, our bump, or this fiscal year, the bump came is we were already cut. We were continuing resolution from 2012, the lowest funding proration in the history of HUD for us. And then in March, we got a 5% cut on top of that because of sequestration. So they took the lowest possible point and cut us by 5%. And what the budget agreement did in January of this year, just a few months ago, is restored some of those cuts. They got rid of the sequestration cuts, and we got a better picture. Still not even close to 100%, because as you see, we're supposed to be serving 13,574 families with $184 million, and a couple years ago, we were only supposed to serve 13,296 for $184
million. Yeah. So when is the mid-year?
I don't think there's going to be one this year.
No. What month would you are you considering, or months would you be considering mid-year? The middle of the fiscal year?
Yeah, the fiscal year. Yeah, January, December, January.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure we're saying the same thing.
Yeah. And for the fiscal year, the fiscal year, it's actually, you know, April, March would be the middle of their year. So if they were going to do some mid-year adjustments at the federal level, the federal budget starts on October 1st, ends on September 30th. You could look for it in March or April. But I don't think there's going to be anything, and I really tend to believe the people who are projecting it'll be a continuing resolution. We'll have the same funding levels. At least with this budget, I think we've been accurate in our projections. And if they change that during the year and we can serve more people, then we'll come forward and try and do those adjustments.
So if there is a mid-year, it'll be the third quarter that we see something happen.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I was just asked to remind you also that our payment standards have increased as well. So even our payment
standards, how much we pay landlords.
So the amount that we pay out increases. So you may see that we're paying more for the vouchers for these families to live because our payment standard has increased as well.
So it's costing us more per unit per month to house someone because rents go up and we get requests for rent increases.
I see. So we have to then
pay the difference.
That's an additional expense.
Right.
There's no compensatory rent.
Because the tenant's portion of the rent is based on their income, and that just changes if there's tenant income. But the landlords can apply for us to get rent increases that we then consider based on market standards because we are, you know, we're a market rate program on the Section 8 side.
And how the Commissioner DeLake.
So following that, the shift from increasing, I guess, declining tenant vouchers to increasing project-based vouchers is part of a strategy to do more project-based where there's a better chance of controlling rents and costs?
That's absolutely true. And it was about, I don't know, the board had a work session on project basing to discuss what percentage. For a normal housing authority, you can project base 20% of your housing choice voucher stock. So 20% not of the non-MTW, but of the housing choice voucher one. So that doesn't include, I guess you can do VASH. I'm right. You can't. So only 20%. We have special authority and permission from HUD in our MTW plan to exceed that if we wanted. At the board, we had a discussion and thought the most we should probably do is about 30%, 33%, right in there, about a third. We haven't reached that. The projections were made prior to redevelopment in California being eliminated, which has derailed some of our pacing on that. But this will take us close to the 20% mark, won't it, Michelle?
Yep.
And so we'll start getting into the extra percentages in the next few years.
And so where you see that leveling out at the 2,200 number for our project-based vouchers, that is once we're moving on into fiscal year 16 and further, that would essentially meet the existing external PBV commitments that we have. And then if any more come online or are approved by your board, then we would add that number, and so that orange line would continue to go up slightly.
Commissioner Castillo.
I think this question is relative to the conversation that we're having right now, which is the economy and how it's affecting our ability to house families, because our families are, you know, of course, are suffering as much as we are trying to juggle this. And so when our families are living under minimum wage and they don't have the upward mobility to increase their income, our vouchers they're more expensive at that point, right? Because our families right. have stagnated incomes, and so we can't, or they lose their jobs. So that plays into account is how does the economy affect the amount of subsidies that we're able to give out.
Yeah.
And the other half of that is something that you talked about is not just the landlords requesting more rent, but there's actually this gentrification that's going on in many of the neighborhoods where they are getting like exceptionally good rents for out-of-towners who don't work in Oakland. And so that must impact us in some way. And I was hoping maybe staff could speak to that and how we can address some of that.
Well, some of that is what Michelle has just told you about, is to make sure that our voucher payment standard is consistent in by area with the surrounding marketplace. And we've had really some excessive rent increases in Oakland going on. And it started last year. And it continues, and maybe there was one report that was up to 13% in one quarter of last year, which we did not verify. We actually, the most we were getting was around 8%. But more recently, you've noticed more going on. And as the real estate market in San Francisco tightens to ridiculous and surreal places, I think we've all seen our neighborhoods flip so quickly. I have mine. I was rather astounded how quickly that occurred, and there's no vacancies. Michelle, do you
mean when you get to look at the board report, you'll see just from March to April almost a 40% increase in rent increase request from landlords. So it is what Commissioner Castillo speaks about is our residents are now in competition with open market tenants, and we have to use rent reasonableness in terms of the rents we want to give them, and sometimes it just doesn't meet what the owners want, so they do rent to, you know, professional non-Section 8 residents. So our residents definitely are in competition now in Oakland. Oakland is seen as highly desirable. West Oakland, around the lake, Central Oakland. So residents are coming in. I've never seen the request for extensions on vouchers that I've seen in the last 6 months. They're just not able to get them utilized in the 90 days that we initially give them. So we are finding voucher extensions for people who are searching are going to the 120-day, 180-day for VASH. We have a resident who's been looking for a unit for almost a year. And Eric has basically said to me, if it's a VASH veteran, extend the voucher. And the regs allow that. So a lot of competition for our residents in non-Section 8.
Wow. Well, I think Commissioner Hearn, did you have a question?
Yes.
Okay, Commissioner Montgomery.
Yes, my question is, how long can you extend the voucher?
So currently in our administrative plan, we can go up to 180 days. Uh-huh. And after that, there's a level of approval. The staff will bring it to me, and I'll look to see has the family been searching, so or if the family's disabled. So there's certain circumstances we will extend it past the 180 days.
Okay. So past 180 days could be?
Usually it's I will approve it for an additional 60. Uh-huh. And then what we're trying to do is get them linked with 211, with services in terms of finding units. Okay. So we might assign a staff person just to call 211 and see if we can get them linked. If they're having security deposit issues, we link them with Season of Sharing. So we really try to get all of the additional services. FCP can come into play in terms of finding out what might be available for residents who may be having issues with search.
Oh, okay, thank you. I just wanted to know because I was had been inquired once about the length of
So an initial 90, yeah, and then we will extend it up to 180, and then after that, we want to see some documentation that the family is making an effort to find a unit.
So is that for all voucher holders, or is that for just one particular?
No, for our voucher, any voucher holder.
Okay, okay.
Commissioner Jung-Lee.
Following that question, if a tenant is unable to find another unit, Is there any special consideration they get for any of the project-based?
No, because project-based each have their own waiting list. But what happens if they're already assisted in a unit, we continue to pay while they're searching. So we're going to continue to pay their landlord as long as they occupy the unit they're in. So we tell families not to move out of their unit until they've located another one, because we will continue to pay that landlord even after the 30-day notice lapses. We'll continue to pay the HAP as long as they're living there and searching.
Okay, Commissioner Mundoff.
Yes, Oakland has a rental assistance center downtown. Does that ever help?
It does. In fact, a couple of months ago, Lenita, myself, and Mark went and did a presentation there and really tried to educate them on what we offer. You know, there's a misnomer that we do emergency housing, and we really don't. But we certainly, our voucher holders walk into that center, and we want them to know who to refer them to here at the authority. We kind of educated them on how our programs work. If we have openings, we send them the listings. For instance, Lions Creek 5, we sent them Cathedral. So they have all those resources in terms of available housing as well.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad to hear that, because I visited their center and, you know, got some information.
Yes, and they have my name, Lenita's name, Mark's name, and I think Greer was also there. So we actually did a presentation on what we do here at the authority.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Maine.
You had your hand up.
Oh, did you have your hand up? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, go ahead. Commissioner Hurd, I'm sorry. I thought maybe you were in and then out, and I wasn't sure.
Oh, no, okay. I was just waiting. Oh, and this question is on page 10. And pretty much I just want to kind of understand the process. Now, it said at the end of 2015, we will have 317 come online from our partners. Now, the partners are new landlords?
So the 317 are actually all project-based voucher units.
Oh, okay.
So those are units that are in the pipeline now. Ave Vista, what are some of the other? I think they're listed there.
Central Alliance Creek.
So those are all PVVs,
okay.
And then some additional OP units that will be coming online.
About 100.
Okay, and then my last question was, I think the director earlier stated that we need to balance them. I didn't understand what that meant.
So what I do is I start to forecast the lease up for units that we have on people who are searching. So 7-1, one of the things that we're going to be looking at is we have poured-in managed families that we haven't absorbed, just around 300 of those. We're talking about absorbing those families, which will immediately give us a bump of about 2%. I then will look at the PVVs that are coming on the market. They're 317. Now, they're coming on November, December, and into 2015. I'll look at how many HCV I can load into that lease up. I might pull 100 HCV in July. We know that we only have about a 20% response because the list is so old. So I might get 20 or 30 from that. I'll then look a couple of months down, see where we are in terms of the PVVs that are coming online, pull an additional 100, because I'm always making sure that the PVVs are commitments we already have. We know that we have to lease those up.
Okay.
So every quarter, really looking at how many HCV families can we pull based on the PVVs that were coming online. Okay. And then, of course, the attrition. We have families that are come up on our deceased tenant report and tenants who are being terminated and those that are self-terminating. So we're balancing that as well.
Okay, great.
And that's all within that 12,805 number.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you.
And Commissioner Castillo.
Thank you very much. Approximately how many families are in attrition every month? Is there like an estimate?
I actually did my math today, looked at it, because I knew you were going to ask me that. It's ranging anywhere from 20 to 30 a month. And that's all our terminations, our deceased tenants. We're definitely have less self-terminating families. Families are feeling this economy, and they're less likely to say, you know what, I think I can make it on my own. Additionally, remember, families now have 2 years when they reach zero HAP to stay on the program. So families are not leaving our program like they did in the past.
So I presume in the nature that we are living under that landlord engagement is really, really an important piece of making sure that we're reaching out to new mm-hmm. landlords and making sure that we're preserving the ones that we have. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, just Saturday, we did an owner appreciation event, and we had about 100 landlords here.
It was pretty full.
And we are always engaging our landlords, letting them know that, one, we appreciate them, two, educating them. So in about somewhere around early July, we will have a rent increase workshop. So quarterly, we'll have a workshop just for owners to help them understand new regulations, issues that we see we're dealing with, rent increases for one, because we're getting so many requests, always educating them on HQS and making sure they understand how to keep their units to that standard. So we definitely, and we have a team that is pretty much dedicated to owners, the owner services team. We did that purposefully under the direction of Eric and Janet to make sure owners had a resource here. And we feel that it's really made our program interesting and one that owners want to be partners with us. So we understand the importance of that.
Commissioner May.
Thank you. When will HUD review and change the rent subsidy structure for the area?
They actually look at the FMRs annually. So right around October, they start telling us if the FMRs for our area are going to go up or down. We then look at the payment standard, and we want to be somewhere between 90 and 110. We don't want to fall below 90% of the FMR. This was the first time that happened, and that's why we actually increased our subsidy for families. Families now have a little more, I say, bargaining power in the market because we increased them. It was about $40 per bedroom size. So every fall, HUD does a study of FMRs for each metropolitan area.
And that's put out when?
Usually we will get it November 1st.
But it's not consistent.
No. Somewhere between September and November, we'll all of a sudden find out the FMRs have changed. So and then we'll do our analysis, and we will then implement changes if we need to.
That's it.
Any more questions?
She has one more
proceed.
Question.
We have
one more question. Okay.
Director, you remember the village mm-hmm. slideshow that we saw on Monday?
Yes.
I thought that was such a creative way to think out of the box as far as housing is concerned. It's the Coyote Village in Washington where, is it 35,000 or 3 million that I think it was 3 million?
Yeah, I think it was 3.5 that they used to create it.
30 little houses and then a big community room, and they actually helped folks who were living in a tent city, about 30 homeless folks, and moved them into these little villages that this nonprofit created out of an empty lot, it seemed mm-hmm. like. And it's creative, out-of-the-box housing, and I don't know if we could do something like that, but it would be kind of cool.
It's rough on a lot of levels. It's rough on zoning and neighborhoods, and it's certainly something that under MDW we can propose a local program of some sort to help provide subsidies, particularly for someone else who is doing it, and that would be an interesting thing to consider. It's rough to run, as you heard. And we don't have any experience in that, so. But it's a wonderful idea. I share that. I think it was an interesting solution, and what it was were a series of little houses. The houses did not have kitchens. They did have only, they had restrooms, but if you wanted to shower and all that, you went to the main community building, and that's where the kitchens were as well. And it was a solution, particularly for a very rough climate, I thought, and an interesting solution. But even they faced a lot of NIMBYism and challenges. Yeah. Okay, moving on to payroll expenditures.
So I'm going to, at this point, hand it over to Tracy to go through the the direction of this fiscal year 2015 budget, and she'll walk you through the next few slides.
Okay. So at the risk of throwing a bucket of cold water on all that information you got on the tenant vouchers, and that takes a lot of payroll to maintain. So we wanted to give you an overview on the expenditures, which is the second biggest expenditure outside of the HAP payments themselves, to kind of give you an idea where we're going with the budget. So in the fiscal 13, if you'll notice in the slide, the payroll expenses were a little bit lower than in the prior years. And then you're going to see a jump up in the fiscal 14. I just want to point out that's because in fiscal 14, we settled our collective bargaining, the three-year agreements with our two biggest ones. So we had some catch-up payments. So some of those expenses really truly belonged in 13, but they were settled in 14. I also want to point out in fiscal 13 and 14, there are benefit and pension payments. And this is where we were doing the pre-funding for our retiree health care and our pension. For fiscal 14, we've estimated it because we actually haven't made that payment yet, but we went to the full board authorization of $7.5 million to pre-fund that again. Okay. So on the next slide, we just wanted to show you that a lot of those payroll expenses are our permanent employees. We've reduced our temporary staff expenditures. For fiscal 14, we are down to 14 temporary employees, and we're estimating approximately $250,000 versus, I believe, it was as high as $1.7 million in 2011. So we've drastically reduced that by converting positions to permanent. We also...
14... says 16.
No, at fiscal 14, there were 16 employees, temporary employees positions.
Down from 64 in 2011. We didn't go back earlier, but you know, it's really essential because if we had not done this, we would not have had the salary savings to show at the end that we were showing at the first in item A.
Okay, and then I did want to point out that there will be a slight increase in temporary staff during the YARDI, the new business system implementation. So we will have some of those, but it's going to be capitalized in the whole business system capital asset.
Yes.
A question in regards to the pensions.
Mm-hmm.
Are the pensions fully funded?
No. The pensions are. Wait, I'm sorry. We made it, yeah.
Our police.
You're talking about the unfunded liabilities, funded.
Yes,
right?
I'm asking about unfunded
right.
liabilities.
The police, our safety plan, is fully funded. Our miscellaneous employee, which is the bulk of the others, by the time we do our pre-funding at the end of this year, as the liability is calculated pre-GASB 68, we will be probably like 90 to 94% funded. So we won't
we're
be 100%.
Most agencies. Janet's going to interject where we are. The rest of the board probably knows because they took the action.
So Janet Rice, Deputy Executive Director. I just wanted to interject that for the police, we are fully funded as of 2012. So we have not gotten the new safety pool numbers for the police. There is also going to be some recalibration in how they calculated at CalPERS. And so as of 2012, we were at zero, so fully funded. But we anticipate that there, because of the changes, we will have to come back to the board, and there probably will be some additional differences that we'll have to try and make up.
And we won't know that till they complete the reevaluation.
And it's supposed to happen this fall. I've actually been in contact with CalPERS on both our OPEB and our pension so that I could get a pretty good sense of what impact that was going to have on us as we were preparing the budget. So right now I think we're in good shape, but stay tuned because I think over the next year or so we'll be coming back and bringing you some updates on what's happening around pension and medical benefits.
But in general, what I would also add is because the board's early direction was to try and pay down our unfunded liability and really stay as current, and we have with the exception of earlier this year where we suspended that we want to now catch up. We have been aggressive at trying to pay this down, and we've made significant strides in that. So the reevaluation, reassessment we'll look at will be, we expect to be in pretty good shape, but it'll probably take some more actions, but it's nothing like you're hearing in other agencies or cities where it can be anywhere from $500 million to $1.5 billion, depending on who does it. Ours is nothing like that. We've done significant pay downs, and we, it's positioned the next generation of people at the agency not to carry the burden. And I really applaud this board for taking that action early on.
I agree. I just want to just remind, because we have new board members, the action that was taken allowed the executive director to pay up to $7.5 million through 2018, which is when we anticipated that our MTW status may or may not change. And so this board took that action in order to make sure that we were covered and could make any adjustments necessary as long as our funding allowed for it.
Is that, sorry, yeah. $7.5 million on an annual basis?
That it is.
I see.
It Thank is.
Mm-hmm. And I can get you the report from that meeting so you'll see what we've done.
And we reported at the end of fiscal 13 in our CAFR that part of that pre-funding is sitting on the balance sheet. There's about close to a $10 million pension asset that we have sitting there due to the pre-funding we've done in previous years. So this $7.5 million will be added to that.
And it's such an important issue because, you know, we are not a city. We are not a state agency. We don't have general fund and tax money that comes into this agency. We are definitely more like a business than we are a government agency, and we really need to pay as we go and provide for our employees. We can't just kick the can because there may not be a can to kick.
Right. I'd also like to add that when you see that on our books as an asset, we cannot get that money back from CalPERS. So unless the Housing Authority completely disbands and transitions that money to another trust fund, it is really restricted. We can't use that for any operations. Once it goes into CalPERS, it does not come out. So it is a fully committed amount of money, even though we have to show it on the asset. The other thing I would say is in the next couple of years, you're also going to see that liability show up on our balance sheet as well. And so you'll be able to see that that was a good investment to go ahead and prepay that rather than waiting for that liability to show up. Like many other government agencies, they're realizing that that is an astronomical potential expense, and some agencies have gone under as a result of that.
No. Cities, exactly.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right.
Were there any other questions on payroll? Okay. So to continue on, the next slide, we just wanted to give you a little idea of how the budget for fiscal 14 versus fiscal 15 compared. So on the left-hand side is the comparison of total revenue. Fiscal 14 obviously was much less than 15 is going to be proposed. And then likewise, on the expense side, we're proposing an equal increase in the expenditures. So on the next slide, what I tried to do was, this is a similar format to the quarterly summary report, but what it's doing is showing you the fiscal 14 budget and compared to the fiscal 15 budget in a little bit more detail. So as you can see, you know, we are showing a significant change in our CFP and RHF, the Replacement Housing Factor Fund grants under the HUD grant, it is dropping by over 50%, and that is due to us using up our allocation. So we've been using some extra grants that we hadn't expended yet in the past, but by the end of 15, we'll have expended everything that HUD gives us. We're also showing, I'll discuss it when we get to the roll-up, but in the other revenue line, that $8.9 million increase is really coming down to showing you the use of reserves from the prior year of about $9 million. So we're putting it in other revenue to show you that we're bringing it into the budget. So you'll see that when we get to the walkthrough. On the expenditure side, administrative expenses are going up 21%, and that's just a reorganization. Again, as I was talking at the quarterly summary, we regrouped how we were putting some of the expenses in central office costs and how we were doing allocations, and this is just a function of trying to concentrate all the expenses into one area so we can allocate them in one calculation. Ordinary maintenance is dropping, and I believe that's more a function of we're catching up with our maintenance, and as the OB rehab is being completed, they're not estimating as much of a need. So what I'd like to do next is to kind of just give you a walkthrough on how the big budget.
Concerning the difference in the administrative expenses, there's a huge increase. Can you tell me again what that's about?
Well, the main driver of that is in prior year in the 14 budget, we presented how we allocated the police department and the administrative departments of property management and asset management and capital improvements as a separate line item. This year, we're putting all the allocations in one place, so it's just reapportioning where they were. It's not an actual increase in how much we're spending. It's just in the administrative expenses where we're capturing it. Right, and some of it you're seeing in the right. Well, protective services, I hand adjusted that to show you because it wasn't comparable. It was off by about $1 million. So that probably is a little misleading because I've actually moved it out of. If you would have looked at fiscal 14, it was actually closer to $6.9 million, and so I changed how we put it in the line item. So if I can walk through, it might become a little bit clearer. Well,
we're going to do next, and we're going to, it's aided right. by the slides.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of walk you through the big roll-up first. Okay. So if I can just walk you through the mechanics of how the roll-up works, I want to go from the right to the left. The last column is our OP, our nonprofit affiliate, and two over column M is CAHI, our other nonprofit affiliate. So we have those that they will be presented to their boards in June for their budget approval, but agency-wide, we include them here so that you can see the whole picture for OHA. So then as you move over, the column L is our leased housing, so that's our Section 8 HCV, our voucher payment. Column K is what we call the AMP level, and that is all of our public housing, both of our asset managed and our property managed public housing units. And then Capital Improvement Department, our asset management and property management departments, columns H and I, that is the administrative piece of it because a lot of those other costs are in the AMP level if it's operational. And this is just the administrative piece of it. Column G is our family and community partnerships, which we separate out so you could see the individual expenses for that department. It's funded by leased housing, but we put it in its own column. Followed by that is the capital fund, and those are literally the grant monies, and then we match the expenses to that. And then our moving to work column is primarily our police department and our real estate development department. And then our central office cost is column D. That is all the other administrative departments from executive office to human resource to finance to IT, et cetera. So then lastly, obviously, is the column total, which is the combination of all of the above. Okay. So on the next few slides, what I just wanted to do was, first I was highlighting in green just some of the areas that I really wanted to highlight because it's some of the special points that we're doing in this year's budget compared to other years. And it's also kind of going to show you how we roll up the allocation. So on the next slide, what I was doing is just highlighting the total column in the line, and then what's highlighted in green all the way across kind of just follows through. So the first slide is total revenue with the operating transfers in and operating transfers out to get to total inflow from operations.
Wait, which page are we on this?
This is going to be on page one of the roll-up and slide number 17.
Okay.
So what that is showing you is the funding that leased housing is going to, the operating transfers is moving the monies out of the MTW column where we receive the leased housing voucher and subsidies, and then we're using those to actually fund the operations of the police department, the real estate department, family community partnerships, and some of our local programs like the OPRI contract.
So let me walk you through this so everyone gets it. In the operating transfers outline, you'll see in leased housing, they're transferring out $8.1 million, which is money that goes into their world because it comes to us from HUD as MTW monies into HAP money. So that's the excess revenue in that program. What you do is you then go to the left and it's the total, so it's 8.175. Then look at the line just above it. That's how it's, that's where the money's going out. And see how they equal each other? So working your way from left to right of the 1.875, so what we've done is taken $8.1 million out of the HAP money that we aren't spending on HAP. We move it into the transfers in. We're going to move it to other departments. So on moving to work line item, we're doing $2.8 million. On family and community partnerships, we're funding it at $3.7 million. And again, move to work is actually the police. So that's how we're funding our police. The family and community partnerships of all our tenant and resident employment, and then go to the far right under local program, and that's the sponsor-based program. Mm-hmm. So what we've done is, what we're trying to just show you is how we move the money in the budget, because it gets very convoluted, even for us sometimes, you know, to sort through it. And we just want to see where the money comes from. It comes from our housing assistance payments that we're not using. We move it then over to the total and then move it to the transfers into other departments, and we use it to fund those three primary areas: the sponsor-based program, family and community partnerships, and our police department. Next.
Okay. No. Isn't this the same thing that we've been doing for the last few years?
We are walking everyone through it so everyone can recall.
I just want to make sure it's not something like new.
No, we just wanted
and
to.
Unusual, because I'm like, wait a minute, I thought we were.
Nothing new, and yeah, this is okay, what we've been doing. Now, I would tell you that we have increased the funding to family and community partnerships.
Okay. That's a different matter, right? I'm just looking at
To fund
approach.
More job training. Which
right, the transfer, you know, yeah. at the transfer payment yeah. approach. Okay, cool.
Okay.
All good.
Tracy?
Okay.
Commissioner Pitts, I think, is the question.
I just wanted to ask real quick if the police have always been under MTW's category 2 for a while.
For several years now.
Okay. So on the next slide, it's the way we've always done it. We've just kind of tried to make it a little clearer. What we're showing you here is 7075-01 and -02, which is other fees, and a new line, the 02, which we're calling the security fees. So the amount that leased housing transferred in is the amount over and above what the police department is allocating and charging to other departments. So the fees in on the security line, if you look just across under the MTW column, is 5.259. So $5 million is what they're going to charge. And if you look on the second page, there's a line that says security expense, and it's going to match that $5,259,000 number. And that's showing you that those charges are going to the AMPS and to leased housing, because that's who the police department serves. So they will charge those amounts to the AMPS and to the HCV program, the MTW program. So we're showing that as revenue on the revenue side coming in. Likewise, the other fees in the central office cost center of $11,928,000, those are allocations that we're charging to the user departments. And you'll see those expenses on, it's not highlighted, but it's the line, two lines above the 918103 security expense, two lines above that is 918102 allocated overhead. And that's on the second page.
So what she's saying is on allocated overhead, you're going to see different departments along the line, not the total, but all the rest of the departments. That's what they're paying to support the central office cost center. So on the revenue side, we book it when we say other fees. If you look at column D, central office cost center, the 11.9, that we're booking as the revenue into the central office cost center that is being paid by our own sites. That make sense?
So wait, say that again. So in other words, other fees, that $23 million.
No, I'm going to the next column because there's other things in other fees. Just the 11.9, column
yes,
D,
okay.
That's the amount of our central office cost center. That appears here as a revenue, but the revenue is actually coming from the operating sites.
The operating sites. It's a transfer payment.
It's a transfer.
Right.
Exactly. Okay.
Okay. Now, is this answering Janie's question from earlier? I mean, I just want to see if is this connecting into that?
Yes.
The 10 million. Because, you know, I'm a little confused on that myself.
Right.
So,
are you talking about the last 10 million?
Okay, so in last year's budget.
Yeah, we'll get into that.
That was that 10 million under administrative expenses.
Right.
That was an allocation issue. I'm just trying to, okay.
Right. So last year, the way the budget was developed, and this is where I was saying I hand adjusted. If you looked at the police department expenses, where they were charged to the individual departments, the AMPS and the leased housing, was in tenant protective services. So you actually saw expenses in that area twice. And we thought that was a little confusing in that, you know, we wanted to show you what it really truly cost to run the police department, which was the $5 million, you know, actually, I think it was slightly under that. The $5 million, if you looked on the 14 budget, it was saying $9 million because they were charging it twice on that budget line item. So what we did was we moved it to administrative expenses into that 9181 column so that you're seeing more expenses in administrative expenses, but you're seeing less in the police department expenses. Okay. So in this scenario, if I had done it exactly the same as last year, on that line item that's 5.7 for protective services, it would actually be closer to 10.
Wait, I got fogged out.
Okay.
Now.
Right.
It would be, so in other words, okay.
Do that one more time.
What does it actually cost to run
the police
department?
So if you look on page, two, yeah. Budgets are always fun. Actually,
total expenses is what you're
I'm trying to find the protective. Okay, 95. So that's on page 4. Total protective services. I'm on the roll up on the big roll up.
On what this big thing? Okay.
Right.
Yeah, we're doing
big sheets. Okay.
Page 4.
Oh, there we go. Protective services, right.
Okay. So protective services, it starts at 9510-01 and goes to 9520-07. So the cost of the police department to provide the protective services is $5,780,857.
Cool.
Okay. So the way it had been done in the past was right alongside with these expenses, we would have charged the AMP level column and the leased housing column for their share of it. So we would have, in essence, recorded it twice. Okay, so protective services would have shown $10 million, part of an allocation and part true expenses. So what we did this year was we didn't want to leave it in protective services. We moved the allocated piece of it up into that account, 9181 security expense.
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Mm-hmm.
I think you're confusing me because you're saying we recorded it twice. That means that it should have been recorded once somewhere and only once.
Well, no, it was properly recorded. You recorded it when you incurred the expense. So when the police department expended money on their contracts, on their labor, on their benefits, you incurred the $5,700,000. Then you would charge the user departments, the AMPS and leased housing, for providing those services. And the base of that is the cost you incurred.
Yeah,
you would have called it an allocated overhead, and they were charging it in the tenant protective services area. And so what I'm saying is we moved it out of there because I think it's clearer to put all your allocated expenses that get charged in one area. So that's why administrative is appearing to be $10 million higher, because we took it out of protective services and moved it into account 9181 and grouped it with administrative expenses.
I only see $6 million for protective services.
Right, correct. So, and what I was saying is that if you look at the 14 budget, we're looking at the 15 budget here. If you looked at the 14 budget, it was double that.
Right.
It was 10 million,
so
right.
That's what I'm understanding is where, if the other 4 or 5 million was not real,
it
double or is there really $10 million?
No, there's $5 million of expenses, and then there's $5 million of allocated overhead charges.
But wouldn't that just, here's a question. Mm-hmm. So does the police department, $5.7 million, and I see over here security expenses of $5.2 million, does that mean that the police department allocates out $5.2 million if it's $5.7 million in expenses?
Correct.
Awesome. Okay, so how did it get to be, I don't think I even want to go there.
No.
How did that bubble before? So in other words, I see. Okay, so the police department is $5.7 million, $5.8 million, whatever, however you interpret that number. And so the bulk of the money then is transferred out to other departments because
Correct.
They're not really protecting themselves, they're protecting others.
Correct.
Right, and so that accounts for the allocation.
Right, and we reduce the allocation from the 5.7 because they also generate fraud recovery income.
They
so
also
we apply that
income
against it first, and then we allocate the remaining balance.
Right, okay, all right, cool.
Are we okay?
All right. Moving on.
I just would like to know, just don't tell me about the $5 million again. Right. I know we are, but I want to be able to understand it so that I understand it. Tell me in its simplest forms, what is the breakdown of the $10.4 million? Just break that down for me and maybe I can get it.
The show us which 10.4 you're talking about.
The one that is over the amount back to the beginning.
That's her original question, okay?
Okay, so the $10.4 million.
Back on slide unknown, because I don't see a number on it.
Yeah.
But it's the fiscal year 14.
So the administrative expenses, the $10.4 million variance from 2014 to 2015.
Just break that down for me, and maybe I'll be able to get it.
So the administrator, the $10.4 million.
Yes.
Okay, so Janet Rice, Deputy Executive Director. So the $10.4 million represents just the variance between what was budgeted in 14 and what was budgeted in 15.
Okay.
And the
why
total, and that's
it
the,
increased
on page 2,
$10 million.
We would have to show you the over on the both line, but I'm going to show you where it is in this budget. On page 2 at the bottom, you see total operating administrative expenses.
Wait a minute, page that's 2 of what? The big chart?
The big chart.
Okay, right, got it.
That's where you find this year's budgeted amount, which is $558 million total. So you can see how it's allocated off. We have 11.3 of admin, and then you see other charges are going, hitting whatever one it's going to be. So that's how we're expending
it
this year.
And
what you want to see is that over last year.
Oh, two people are talking to me,
okay.
So hold on just a minute. I'm sorry, Director, please continue.
So that line of operating administrative is rolling up, and what they're showing you on this one is last year it was $10 million less, and what Tracy's trying to do is allocate differently because she's using a cost allocation plan, right?
The bulk of the $10 million is going to be lines 918103, the security expense, and 918104, the capital improvements department expense.
And how
because
much is that together?
That is 7.2.
So that's 7.2, and then
correct.
We're still missing 3.
Okay.
Well, the 3 is just,
just,
I think,
regular.
It is general staff increases, benefits increases, and it could increase.
Right.
And
majority
also
of it is salary and benefits.
Okay, so it's normal livable wage, normal increases of $3 million that are expected.
Correct.
And keep in mind, we did the 2014 budget, not this one. We didn't have the deals with. We didn't know what the increases were going to be, and the COLAs and the retroactive COLAs. Now we do.
But this budget reflects a 1% increase that the board approved effective July 1. So that's where you get the difference in the salary increases and the benefits.
But it also last year's, the 2014, didn't include the MOU payments for COLAs and the increased medical, because we did not have that when we did the 2014 budget. So we got all caught up by two contract waves and during the past year, but when we did the 2014 budget, we didn't know what those COLAs were going to be, and they were retroactive. So it's been a lot more than 1%. It's actually catching up completely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Steph, for your patience. I understand. I appreciate your time.
Good for you. I'm not sure I
do. Okay.
Commissioner May.
Speaking of COLAs, is there a way that we can project some of that in the budget?
Historically, the way that COLAs have been handled is that we have not included them in the budget, because basically that sort of leads you down a path prior to negotiations with some assumptions. And I think that based on my involvement in negotiations, it would not be looked upon favorably for us to assume anything, because it is a negotiated process. So just in piggybacking what Director Johnson said, when we initiated the 14 budget, it did not include the 2.5% that we ultimately gave staff, and we had to come back to the board once those final numbers were disclosed and incorporate those in the 14 budget. So I would say that it would not be, my experience, it has not been a wise move to put anything in the budget. You always come back because it's a negotiating point. You want the board to know what the impact of any negotiation decisions are. And because it involves such a large sum of money, both on the salary side as well as on the benefit side, you want to be able to have that ability to tell us whether or not it's something that's acceptable to you.
In this year, we're in the unique position for us of knowing what the COLA is and having agreements. So
that is
included, as is the increase in the medical that was approved this year.
So that brings me to my next question, which is what I expected you to say. And we wouldn't want to discuss that here anyway in open session. Okay. But is there a way that when we negotiate, we can negotiate so that we know ahead of time what this is going to be? Because we negotiate a little bit early from doing it like behind.
I fully support that.
Well, we all support that, and
before,
I believe there is a reopener.
And we do have a reopener
In the spring of 15.
Of this coming spring for the COLA, and so we'll just the COLA. Mm-hmm. And then we'll do that for the third year, and then we do have the whole contract opening up again fourth year, so 2 years out. But we're going to give it a shot, and we're hoping we get something.
Okay, now we're talking.
Were there any more questions on that page?
Yeah, I'm still stuck on the $10.4 million. Is that a reclassification of expenses? Is that what that is?
Yes.
Okay, that's good. That helps.
Okay.
All right.
So the last thing I wanted to bring to your attention on the revenue side is account 715005, which is a new line we added to the 15 budget for reserves. And this amount, the $8,758,000, represents reserves that we had budgeted in fiscal 14 that we did not utilize. So if you recall the quarter report I just gave, we had significant cost savings, so when we had budgeted a fairly large deficit that we're not realizing at this point. So some of the things, we just wanted to bring those reserves forward and use them, because there are some capital items that we didn't expend in the fiscal 14 yet that we still feel are necessary, so we were going to utilize those reserves in the current year, in the 15 budget.
Yeah, I'm going to assume that the big one, $5 million, under capital improvements, is on some of our public housing sites?
It's former public housing sites.
Some of it is public housing?
Yeah, and then the bulk of it, though, is on our project-based Section 8 properties and our FORCE account. Yeah.
And in fact, I'd say a significant amount, almost all of the $8 million is for deferred capital from fiscal 14. Most of it is all capital items.
Okay.
So now I'd like to point out to you one of the bigger expense items on the last page.
Wait a minute.
Page 5.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
Is there, in your highlights, it doesn't show the difference between 2014 and 2015.
No, this is a snapshot. The slides themselves are a snapshot of the 15 budget.
Right.
So we didn't actually do a comparative on the line items. I just did a very high-level comparative to the 14 budget.
So do you have that information? I mean, could you tell me?
Well, I did the comparative slide 16, where we talked about it, and at the bottom it is showing you the capital items, where we had in fiscal 14 we had budgeted capital and affiliate loan, that's our construction or real estate construction partners. The budget was $19,553,000 versus this year in fiscal 2015 we're budgeting $24 million.
I don't have numbers on most of my slides.
Well, I had to write them down so I could know. She has it on, yeah.
Right, and it's the second from the bottom, the line that says capital and affiliate expenditures. Mm-hmm. So the left-hand column is your fiscal 2014 capital expenditures that we had budgeted was $19,553,000. Right. And then in 15, we're budgeting $24,076,000.
Show anything about
right.
Reserves.
Well, now remember, on the $24 million, that includes capital expenditures in the current year and in the prior year that we hadn't purchased. So I don't know if you had looked at the fiscal 14 in the recent past, but there in there was the 1540 Webster was budgeted for expenditure, the business system. There were a lot of capital improvement department expenditures that did not occur, so they're reoccurring in that $24 million. It wasn't that we're increasing it from 14 to 15. It's just that you're going to see in the 14 budget we were significantly under budget in capital expenditures, and those are the monies that had not been spent. So we're
so
bringing those reserves into the 15 budget.
Yeah. Yeah.
To actually
yeah.
spend
so
them.
I was going to ask that question. I'm glad you said that.
Okay.
But I still didn't see the reserve difference. That's budgeted.
Right. It's not. It's not the difference. That was just the amount where we said these are the amounts that we budgeted last year, and then we brought them up. If you look on the line for 715005, like under the central office cost center, that $1,515,000. Is the business system. So part of that was budgeted in prior year, and we're wanting to use the reserves that we didn't use last year towards that capital expenditure. And then likewise, under the capital improvements department, the $4,999,000, that was part of last year's capital budget, and it did not get expended, so we're bringing it into this year's budget.
Right, I understand that.
Okay.
Okay, so my question was, what did we budget for the reserves last year?
Well, we budgeted to go over our budget by $20 million, I believe. So that was implied that we were going to
use
reserves up to $20 million to cover that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we're only
and we did not use it.
Cover, it's not just cover that, to cover the leasing issue for. I mean, there were many things in the deficit last year that we approved that we ended up, but. For these monies, it was stuff that there are initiatives that are going on. We budgeted them last year knowing that we may or may not reach the expenditure, and we just haven't. We're just carrying forward funds to finish our new business system and finish rehabs and capital expenditures. Yeah.
Right. I understand that we have projects that we put forward that didn't get funded mm-hmm. completely yet, and so we're carrying them over. Okay. And we're going to end up spending the money, It's just in what year or what quarter or whatever it's spent. But I just wanted to know, what is it that we budgeted last year versus what we're budgeting this year? And I know we're carrying some of it over, and that's part of the budget. But that, to me, should be a little bit separate from what we're budgeting. In other words, if we're saying we want to budget in $5 million for reserves, that should be a new $5 million, but we're carrying over last year's reserve of $5 million, so it's going to be a total of $10 million.
So in essence, what you're asking for, because the new category that's on page one that's identified as reserves of $8.7 million total, so if you go to the last page and you see excess revenue over expenses of $7.5 million, so really, it's the difference. That's that $8 million, we normally would not have shown it included in the budget. But for clarification purposes, we added that $8 million on page one so that you could actually see that that $7.5 million, if you didn't have that $8 million in there, it'd be greater. So that basically, if you add that deficit $7.5 million, and you add the 24, that's how you come up with the 31 overall. So you're using in reserves 8.7 million of new reserve money that you're using for this year.
Right.
Okay?
Coming up.
Yeah. You're coming up by eight. And what we wanted to do was make sure that every year from here going forward, you will be able to see how much money you're using. It's what's left over from last year's reserves plus $8.7 million in this year's reserve money that we're using.
Okay. I see it now. That's where you get the 31.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, I think it's beginning to become clear. I think that what would be really helpful here is to have explanation of variances. So that when we see these large numbers like $10 million, even if it's a reclassification, just have that linked to something that we can see. If it's a reclassification, it's debits and credits or something, you know, that's just, you know, things on one side or the other side of a ledger.
Right.
It would just help to be able to track it that way, I think. And you know, likewise, when there is a cash flow timing issue, for example, if our cash flows were under target in year A, whatever year that is, and then there's catch up in year B, just simply because, you know, we couldn't break ground or whatever happened to delay the project, that would certainly help me, and I think it would make my understanding a lot more efficient.
Okay.
To kind of guide through those.
Okay, we appreciate that feedback. I would hope that in going forward in the future that we would not have a $10 million adjustment in terms of how we're categorizing things. This has sort of been an evolutionary process over the last couple of years in terms of getting our arms around how the agency manages its resources and what would make it more easy for you all to understand and see the flow of funds that are going through the various accounts.
I think the approach is excellent. It's just that it's not so quick for people that aren't immersed into, you know, we're just kind of showing up once a month, and so it's slightly harder for us to grasp this really quickly, without having a good think of it as like a thread,
absolutely,
know, to guide us through the chaos, and then it won't be so chaos, because transfer payments in particular can just blow people's minds.
Right.
And so it I mean, they really can. I mean, transfer payments can get so complicated, it's just absolutely crazy. But they can be explained so that they're not so shocking even to the amateur brain.
Right. We're going to have a big adjustment, is what I'm hearing, is just to make sure it's in a simplified format so that you all can follow it and tie it back to the numbers consolidated.
It's just to have the addition. An addition of the explanation of variance. Well, it's a similar thing to what Commissioner Hurd was just saying, can we have footnotes? And I think what I'm talking about is the same thing.
Okay.
Because what it really is it's an additional explanation to kind of guide us. When there's big number changes like that, you know, I mean, all of us who are former financial people are like, what's that?
I agree. Thank you for that feedback. We appreciate that.
Is there
Yes.
Chairman Hartwig. Do you often provide balance sheets so we can get an understanding of the total assets and liabilities?
No. Our quarterly summary reports are what we usually walk the board through, because we don't typically do interim balance sheet type transactions at all. When we get our new business system, then that may be a possibility. But right now, we have not a user-friendly system. So when we compile financial statements, it's a very labor-intensive process for our staff to go through the exercise of, because we're trying to pull data from multiple systems and aggregate that and to be able to present.
So if we have a question of what is your accumulated reserve,
mm-hmm.
You can give that to us.
Yes, we typically have a discussion with the board solely on the reserves at a separate meeting, so that you can basically tie back where we were last year and then all of the approved commitments, as well as all of the payments that we've made in accordance with our agreed upon schedules.
And it's important, particularly when we start investing again, what our reserves levels are and what they're going to, how we're going to expend them. But it isn't just reserves, it's also then plays in other funds, replacement housing factor funds that are available in addition to reserves to use. And they're really not reserves because most of them are obligated. So they're obligated funds. Even though they're showing as reserves, there's been actions the board have taken to obligate those funds. So for example, at Ave Vista, if you have $6.5 million that the board has obligated and we have only expended $1.7 million, the remaining amount will show on one line item as a reserve, meaning it's been obligated, so it's not really held in terms of available funds. So there's also the available fund question that comes in.
Well, weren't we getting, wait a minute, I thought we were getting quarterly reports on reserves as part of the dashboard. Now more recently, reserves haven't become as key an issue as they were a couple years ago, but actually they probably should be. But
and that's best dealt with, I think, in the way that we've done in the past, is we will have a reserve schedule. We usually do that in closed session related to real estate transactions and things we want to do, and that'll be
part of
the next round. We'll look at what direction we want to go in terms of different activities, and it can be development, it can be reinvestment in current housing stock, it could be any number of things, but to do that takes a degree of work and a period of time that we have to prepare for, is what Janet's saying.
And I think part of what happened was we had, as Eric was saying, most of our reserves are actually committed. So that's why you haven't seen as much attention to reserves now, because they've been committed and we haven't been able to get more reserves, and so we're just kind of executing the commitments that we had previously made now. But that is a really good point on the reserves.
And I just wanted to point out, like in the quarterly summary that I had mentioned, we put capital outlay in the affiliate loan expenditures. Those are typical balance sheet items. And until I would actually make the adjustment to put them back on the balance sheet, if I gave you a balance sheet, it would be significantly understated because of that adjustment is typically only done at year end. Okay, so to move on, I wanted to point out a couple of the bigger expenditures. On the last page, under non-routine expenditures, I wanted to point out the unit rehab material costs and the Capital Improvements Department unit rehab labor charges. Those are almost all the scattered site renovation costs that we're going through with the OP sites. So it's slightly less than it was last year, but we continue on with the renovation project. And then lastly, if I could bring your attention to the very bottom, the excess of revenue over expenditures entity-wide is a deficit of $7.5 million. And then we have budgeted capital expenditures of $24,076,000 to net a final excess of revenue over expenditures of $31,623,000. The expenditures are comprised of several things. As I mentioned earlier, $1.5 million is for to continue with the business system implementation. I believe $10 million is for the 1540 Webster Street build out and move. And then $6 million is more use of the replacement housing factor funds and capital fund grants to our affiliates for their construction projects. And then CID has approximately, you know, $5 million in site-wide public housing and Section 8 improvements. So. There were any more questions?
That's her presentation. The other thing I would point out, as I did, we did an estimate for commissioner travel of $35,000 for the year. That was based on an average of $5,000 per commissioner, and that's been included. The board can consider that or make any revision as well. And I think that's been our entire report.
Okay. Thank you. I know this is rough work. This is a lot of complicated.
Last year we actually submitted our audited financial statements. We bumped it up to a comprehensive annual financial report, which is a format that the GFOA will grade and consider for the issuance of the certificate. They also have a program for budgets, and I think one of some of the changes we're making here are trying to get in compliance with their best practices. So at some point in the very near future, we hope to actually recommend to submit the budget for their approval and review.
Yeah, and I can see the improvements here. I mean, good. Significantly. It's very cool.
It still can give you a headache, though. Go
ahead. It's still giving me a headache. That's right. Because, this is a complicated organization.
Well, and it's $711 million. The majority is pass-through money, but the rest of it can be very complicated.
It does a lot of things in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I really appreciate that those pages that you showed, the variances between the two. I wish it was possible that for every line item, we could have looked at the budget and there was another column that talked about, okay, this was last year, this was this year's on this, so that we can see, and you probably put in yellow the ones that were new.
Right.
So that we would know this is a new line item versus what happened for last year, and we could understand that a little bit better, and so we could, you know, put that into perspective rather than have it in the small, trying to go back and forth,
right,
all on one page, I mean on one report.
And I've actually put that in my notes. We'll definitely add a 14 column
and
mixture.
I know we're supposed to vote to approve the budget as is, but I got a couple of issues with the budget just as it is, and I think a lot of us still don't understand and have some questions on it. I think it'd be great if we, and I'm gonna make a motion that we have a budget committee that looks at some of this and ask that commissioners present it with questions so that we can review that and bring it back so that we can address it, because I know it's a lot to digest. I mean, I think it was done very well and presented very well, but I think we still need to look at it. And I do have some significant issues with the commissioner's travel part, but I don't want to just stick to just that one thing. I think we should look at it comprehensively and address it from that. And I would also add to my motion that I would like to sit on that committee so I can bring some perspective from what we did in years past and some of the history so that we can be understanding. Now, it might be possible somebody doesn't want to do a committee, but have it as a closed session. We talked quite a bit about having a workshop session soon, but I don't think it's going to be timely. So that's the reason why I'm trying not to involve everybody, but put it into a committee so that we can at least address it and talk about it and bring it back. That's my motion.
I know you have the motion, but you can't discuss the budget in closed session.
Okay.
So I'd like to make a motion to put it into a committee, have a budget committee to address some of the questions and issues.
I'll second that and would like to sit on it, if that's okay.
Okay, we have a motion. Motion has been seconded.
Are there any questions?
Are there any questions? Yes.
What are some of the particulars that do you want to commit for the entire budget? Are there particulars in the budget?
Most
besides
of it.
Besides the commissioner's travel, what are
Oh, there's some particulars, okay. We talked about some of them, and I want to flesh it out a little bit more, especially like in the development area. One of the things that I'm concerned about, and I've looked at, and I've mentioned to the chair, we have in our district, District 6, approximately 3-4 pieces of property that are vacant that we have no, I know that's a business item for the whole thing, and it's not necessarily a budget item, but we want to look at if there are budgeted monies so we can talk about how we can develop that or look at how we might be able to develop it or improve it from the way it is right now. And so that's a more larger discussion, but it's something that we can look at to see if there's money in the budget so we don't have to make it a larger discussion. It might be something, that's one of the things.
Okay. That, yeah, that's my answer. I just, you know, wanted to know if, you know, what was some of the, so would that be, okay, the prop in District 6, would that be?
It's East Oakland.
I know where that is, yeah. Could that be brought into this committee?
Well, I'm not sure exactly. What I think you're referring to are the state properties that we received, the single family homes?
No, we purchased properties. They're just vacant land, like the one you
vacant,
just tore
vacant
down.
Vacant land.
The vacant land like Bancroft and 77th?
Yeah.
Those I think are really, it's currently vacant. It's not held by the Oakland Housing Authority. It's actually CAHI, and it goes to the CAHI board, not the Housing Authority's board, so it wouldn't be something this board would consider.
Well, actually,
it would be CAHI's board and not ours. I would encourage people to consider what you want to do. We have to pass the budget by June 30th of the fiscal year, which would mean we could hold another meeting if you'd like. But the question is it beneficial and is it going to do anything, or do you want to do it separately for different issues? If you want to talk about what we're going to do at 77th and Bancroft, to start with, it would go actually through the CAHI committee who's working on that issue and has been for the past year. Wouldn't hit this budget. It wouldn't hit the OHA side of it. So I think that it's really a question of the board of what, if you want to establish a committee to consider something different or make a motion to change something in the budget, but I would really encourage you to take action on the budget tonight. So that's my recommendation. And you can establish any other working committees you'd like, and they can look at whatever. And if there was something they wanted to change in the budget, we can always propose a budget revision during the year based on that.
And there's another piece of property that's between MacArthur and Ney.
That's on MacArthur. There is a lot. The lot was given to us by the city. It used to be a motel. It was torn down. We've had a couple of interests. One interest from Habitat, but it didn't really work out. They kind of mocked it out with Phil, but there's no plans for that at this point. That, again, is something that I think the board should consider if there's some idea to use it or something viable. Right now, there's not. It's a property we take care of in terms of we do mow it occasionally. But whether or not it's viable for development is questionable at this point, according to real estate. And it's, again, something that a committee could look into. I don't know that it would really impact this year's budget.
Yeah, that's the question. And do we have money to address some of that? In the reserves is what I was looking at. That's why I was asking questions about reserves, because if we don't have much reserves, then we can't really do anything, and maybe we should budget it a little bit more so that we can have some to talk about. Like you talked about on that Bancroft one, having a community garden. Okay, I get questions all the time, but what are you guys doing with that property? It's still vacant land, okay? And I want us to at least have answers so that we can address it. And we haven't even talked about it. And I think that's something that we can throw in there I mean, if you want to just move it in or if you want to just pull those items out so, you know, we can discuss
well,
them.
One of the things that we've been talking to and the chair and I have had conversations about is getting doing another board retreat similar to the one that we did a few years ago, but we probably wouldn't do it until closer to the end of the federal fiscal year when we know what those fundings are. And then we have to make plans for the replacement housing factor funds in the next year. So we're looking at doing a board retreat that was going to look at our properties, which ones we're talking about, which what do we want to develop there, and how do we want to expend that. But that really won't impact this year's budget whatsoever.
This, you mean next year's?
Yeah, the 2015.
Okay,
yeah.
You said this year's, I wasn't sure.
Yeah, this budget.
Yeah, so anyway. There's a question.
Okay, yeah, Commissioner.
Go ahead, go ahead. No, she has a question.
I believe the idea of a budget committee is good, and I'd be interested in serving as well. I'm wondering, for purposes of accommodating the deadline, whether the budget committee could be formed and it could meet as needed, and we could still go forward with considering whether to approve this budget tonight. Would that work for you, Moses?
I think we can say we tentatively approve the budget with the caveat that the budget committee can come with suggestions and we can make some changes.
Well, that's the board's prerogative. We can always do budget revisions. So if you do have a committee and you have any revisions you want to recommend, then it would come back to the board, yeah, the full board, and they'd make those recommendations. That's not a problem.
Yes.
So, as a former nonprofit administrator, I was told never to bring a deficit budget to the board. Mm-hmm. So I do have still some further questions. So maybe this is a much more common routine.
It is, and it's the way we handle
local housing authorities and HUD.
Yeah, and it's also not necessarily a deficit.
Right.
Is okay. What you don't understand. It's right. Really using money that we'd already obligated
in other ways
in this year. So it represents in our budget as a deficit, but it's really the investment that we're making into the different.
So I think it gets back to the question of accumulated reserves. So mm-hmm. The deficit $7 million and the deficit $24 million for capital expenditures.
And the budget committee
there's money
yeah.
for it.
Yes.
Elsewhere.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Not reflected here.
In our reserves, one of the things we're currently under discussions with HUD about in terms of the MTW program is, are our reserves committed or obligated? And what is our unrestricted reserves? Because it's what they're trying to get at is what is the unrestricted, meaning it's not been committed by the board, it's not obligated by the board for a purpose. What is the amount that we actually have? And then how much should we have? We don't have any real guidance yet from HUD. There's a debate around how many months of reserves, operating reserves, we should have. And that would be an interesting ad hoc committee to look at, I think.
Yeah, we could discuss that there, too.
Do you have a question? No, I was just going to say that I think because of the way the accounting is done, that you could look at the budget as being a negative cash flow, right? But it's not necessarily a negative budget, all right? So now this will make more sense to people who have been here for a while, but it has to do with the fact that as Eric was saying, with the investment projects that we have undertaken and made commitments to in the past, and that accounts for the obligation of the reserves. So you're not just looking at money that's coming in and going out this year, you're looking at money that has come in different ways in the past, right, that is now finally being spent because the project is now arrived at the point where it needs that money, okay? And so that's really a matter of increasing affordable housing in the city of Oakland. That's what that's all about. Is that a fair way to say it?
Absolutely. So if you have a commitment, you made 10 point some odd millions into Lion Creek Crossing 5, and we did that 4 years ago, 3 years ago, that money's now been committed. So it's just waiting to be put into the budget and expended out, and that's really what drives the figure you're talking about. In terms of this budget, one of the things we looked at is how much reserve could we have and could we fund getting our Section 8 voucher utilization up to 100%, which is what we talked about earlier, which I think is something we really want to do and maintain. A lot of Move to Work agencies have lowered their voucher payment, their voucher lease-up rate lower. They go below 100, below 90 even. One of the things that HUD has said is to be eligible to be renew your contract for the 10-year extension that they've offered is that we need to be above 90% utilization, because some MTWs have lowered their utilization and they use that money for different purposes and mostly for development activities. It's a strange business to do a Housing Authority's budget, because you project revenue based on unforeseen revenue, because you never know when you're doing the budget what is going to be actually funded. So you're doing projections and that can change. And then if you do have reserves that you have available, then what you do as a board is take action to obligate them in future years. So you preserve your access to those funds and then you expend them as a deficit funding that year because of the way it enters the budget.
Does that help at all?
I'll keep learning. Thank you.
Do you have a comment?
I just want to say that I also agree. I think we do need a budget committee. It's the first year that I've been on the commission that we haven't had one, and I think it's a lot smoother process when we have one, because we have lots of commissioners have taken a look at it before. That said, I'd like to make a friendly amendment to the motion on the floor to say that we tentatively approve the budget tonight, and that the committee is empowered to make any changes at it, and it gets brought before the board in its final version next month.
I'll second that.
Well, I would also...
do you accept
the friendly amendment?
Yeah. Is that cool. Legal to do?
Well, I don't know you can tentatively approve or just... I mean, I don't know what that accomplishes. You either approve or you don't. And the budget committee, if you were to do a committee, can always come back during the course of a year and make budget amendments. If you want to have a budget ad hoc committee for this year's fiscal budget between now and the next meeting in June, then I think we should probably just do that.
Okay. Sounds like that.
It's cleaner and it's easier. But we'd want to make sure we get that scheduled right away so that we can get that done and we can come back in June, because we do have to pass our budget by June 30th. And the reason we always come a month early is for this reason, is so that we have one meeting left before the end of the fiscal year.
And I would also add to that, we have contracts that we'll be bringing forward to you that begin on July 1.
Yeah,
so one of the things that is important that we know is that we can go ahead and move forward, because you're going to have a lot of contracts coming before you that will start effective July 1. And so we try to time it now so that it used to be we were down to the wire, but we wanted to make sure that when people want to start work, or if their contract is expiring June 30th, that there's no delay. And that we're holding up, if we have invoices, that we can pay and make sure that there's a smooth process.
So I'll withdraw my motion.
I'll withdraw my second.
Call the question.
Can I ask a question? So
Eric,
you said something about a revision. So would a revision have to come into a budget committee meeting, or how would that work?
If there was a budget committee meeting and they were to make revisions to the budget, mm-hmm. then that would come back to the board to approve the revised budget.
Okay. So what's the timeline? This is May, next month is June, so the committee would have to meet between now and
the next
in
the next probably 3 weeks. Yeah.
3 weeks.
And of course, the other option is to approve the budget and then convene the meetings or meeting that you need, and then come back if you want to make any changes.
You have a question?
Yeah, she called for the question.
Call for the question?
That means we have to vote.
Oh, I just wanted to make one comment first, and I think you know, I just want to make sure that if we're doing a budget committee. If we're doing a budget committee, that the committee really focuses on the budget, because I think that while some of the properties that we have that we would like to do things with and we would like to look at, I don't really think that's a budget issue. I understand the budget bears upon that, but I don't think that's a budget issue. I think that's a business planning strategy issue, and I think it would be fine to have a committee that focuses on that. But essentially, it's the decisions that drive the budget. The budget doesn't really drive the decisions unless there's not enough money to do something. In which case we would have the problem anyway. So I just want to make sure that we're going to address problems or issues with the budget and not move this off into other things, because we're pressed for time. And I think we really have to be focused on this. The other thing I wanted to say is that we sent out an email weeks ago, saying that because there were not big changes in the budget, and it was pretty much straight line, that I suggested we don't have a budget committee. Not one person, if one commissioner had written back, one, and said, no, let's have a committee, we'd have a committee. Not one responded to say, let's have a committee. So just leaving that on the table there, okay?
But I called you. You didn't say it was a formal response, but I did call you before.
You did not okay. say to oh, me, oh, we need a committee.
I'm sorry. When a question is called, that means there's no more discussion, and we have to vote.
All right, cool. All right, so... All right, so we have a motion that's been seconded. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? All those abstaining?
I'm not clear what the motion is.
Oh, the motion is, are we going to have a budget committee?
No, I made a motion for
yes
a budget
or no.
committee.
Okay. The motion is to form a budget committee. So it's, are we going to approve that or not?
For this particular budget.
Right. Correct.
And if that didn't hit the mic, an ad hoc committee for the fiscal year 2015 budget is what
right.
is on the table.
Ad hoc committee for the 2015 budget.
Yes.
Okay. So since there was confusion over that, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed?
I oppose.
Abstentions? I abstain.
Abstaining.
Okay, two, abstain. Okay, so the motion carries. So we will have a budget committee. I will figure out who's on the committee within the next day or two.
Okay.
You had two, three volunteers.
The chair can, name.
We can still do the budget, though.
We had three volunteers.
Well, so, but you can choose when you
appoint somebody. Put your name to the member so you can do it whenever you want.
Yeah, I just wanted to think about it for a day and decide what would be the best composition for the committee, because we have a number of people that want to be on it.
Oh, good.
And so just give me a day or two to figure it out.
Only four.
We'll take it. We can't have four. On it.
I know.
All right.
Is that the lemonade one?
Okay.
Thank you, commissioners.
All right.
Next item, consideration of a resolution authorizing the executive director to renew the general commercial liability insurance policy with the Housing Authority Risk Retention Group for the period of June 1st, 2014 through May 31st, 2015, and to make the payment in the annual amount of $207,198. This is a routine insurance renewal that is being presented. And I don't know that there's anything significant to report in the past year. Other than we, I think, have gotten a pretty good rate, and our participation with the HAI group, and in this case the HAIG, which is one of their subsidiaries, has continued to provide us reasonable and good coverage, and we're having a decrease from the last year of $8,865, and that concludes our report.
I'll move the item.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Who's the second?
Marlene.
Okay. Marlene. All those opposed? Any abstentions? Hearing none, motion carries unanimously.
All right.
Item D was withdrawn, so we are now moving to item E, recognition of people wishing to address the commission. I don't have any speaker cards. Do you?
None. There are
okay.
no speaker cards.
There are no speaker cards, so we're now moving on to written communications.
Written communications. I've included the usual monthly report. Behind the monthly report, a couple things I want to call out. We also have the monthly report from Ivalsi out at Lion Creek Crossing. For your review, there are a couple letters that I've included. One is the utilization letter from Assistant Secretary of Public and Indian Housing, Sandra Enriquez, who provides us an offer to extend our move to work. This has actually run into a couple of little concerns that we are hearing about, not formally from HUD. One is from General Counsel and the other is OMB, and I'll talk a little bit about that in my comments at the end. The other one is the new flat rent provision, a letter from HUD that was provided to the Housing Authority, and this is the 80% fair market rent issue that I mentioned last month. I also wanted to include an update from Washington, from NARO, in terms of what they're doing to try and have some changes to this. We're really looking closely at the data with Dominica to try and figure out how many people are affected. It's just between 40 and 50, and how much the rent increases would be. And I'll probably be coming back to you in the next month or so with something related to that, because it really will have a significant impact on our residents, depending on what's issued with HUD as a rule. So they haven't issued their final rule, is what the crux of the NARO letter is. And once they do, we may have to take some action, and we don't have much discretion. We're hoping during the rulemaking process that they're taking into consideration the enormously high HUD fair market rents that we have to increase our flat rents to. And that's all my written communications.
Wow. Do we have an executive director's report?
We do. I have several things I want to talk about. Number one, I attended the housing, the California Hotel opening, which not only recognized one of our board members, Lynette Jung Lee, for her heroic work at taking on that project, but also our own Doug Lee, who works in leased housing, and Doug works tirelessly on the project-based Section 8 side. And he was recognized by a Balsi, which was a really wonderful thing for them to do. He's a terrific, quiet guy who gets his job done very well, and I really was appreciative of them considering him, and I know Michelle was as well. I attended the Summer Youth Employment Breakfast this month, which was trying to increase the number of companies involved in the Summer Youth Employment Breakfast. I got to speak a little bit, which is always fun, because it's good to encourage people to do the right thing, which is to support more of our youth getting summer jobs. It can make such a difference. I participated at the At-Risk Seniors Panel on Affordable Housing Week that was created by St. Mary's Center and the Mayor's and the City of Oakland Mayor's Commission on Aging. Put it together, and Donna Murphy, and I think that it was an interesting morning, and I was grateful to be able to participate. OHA hosted, finally, Leased Housing hosted it, Owner Appreciation Day last Saturday, really well attended. It had breakout sessions in the morning and then a larger session on issues that really, I think, help some of our owners. You know, most we serve about 7,000 owners in Oakland. We work with about 7,000 owners. Most of them are just mom and pops. They're small shops, and I think those particularly really appreciate the legal advice they get. We bring on outside attorneys who they can ask questions to help them navigate some of the rental housing laws, particularly in Oakland, that can get kind of complicated. And I really want to thank Michelle and Tila Carpenter and the whole team who worked Saturday to put that on. They did a great job. Moving on, OHA, also OHA that very same morning, actually, Lenita Ellis participated in the Walk to End Hunger, and she got a little contingent from OHA, and I want to thank her for doing that. I missed the start because I was actually here, and we were kind of late, and by the time I walked over there, because they had all already done it, so I didn't get to see the kickoff. So I'm sorry I missed it, Lenita, but thank you for doing it and taking that on. Chair Hotwig and I both attended the League of Women Voters luncheon with resident leaders, which was terrific. We had our resident leaders sitting at the table with us, and I hope they enjoyed themselves and got a chance to kind of see how the workings of that kind of function goes. Secondly, I wanted to announce that Secretary Donovan is reportedly, based on an article this weekend, moving to OMB and will be no longer the Secretary of HUD. This is reported by major people, including the New York Times. And Julian Castro, who's the mayor of San Antonio, is being vetted to replace him. And Julian Castro has a brother who's in the House as well. But it's been kind of all over the press then today why he's making the move, and he's being quiet on it, but that's what's being reported. So what it means, and the reason I bring it up, is we also have Assistant Secretary of Public and Indian Housing, Sandra Enriquez, who wrote us the letter about the extension. She will be leaving HUD in June, and no successor's been named. And that creates challenges related to getting a 10-year extension if they're the two people who have committed to doing it. The two challenges we have, first, it was HUD's general counsel who stated at a meeting that that in Washington, in the CLAFA meeting, when she was there, that HUD General Counsel came in and said they really didn't want to move forward for the extensions for anyone because two of the MTWs were in lawsuits against HUD. And they're not us, but it was going to impact everyone. I think that issue's kind of died down considerably with General Counsel, but then some people were in the room with some HUD officials from FATA that I know, and they emailed me when they got out of the meeting because there was a comment made by someone at HUD that there were concerns at OMB. So we're trying to sort through what that means. We haven't heard anything official from HUD that it's being in any way changed or derailed, but I just want you to be aware of kind of those changes in Washington that may impact the extension through 2028. The fiscal year 2012 appropriations, I mentioned this during the budget process, that there's some discussions about language going into appropriations. One of them could have a really negative impact on how the, again, MTW monies get handled, and they're being kept within the HUD lock system rather than with OHA, and some language that could allow HUD to recapture what they think are available funds. So we're working on that and trying to make sure that the people who have any say can maybe change some of that language. And I, it's another fight. I honestly don't think we're going to have an appropriation bill this year, but you want to try and get damaging language out of any draft, because in Washington, it has a history of carrying over to the next year and the next year. So we're going to be talking to several folks again to try and correct some of the language. If you remember, we were successful at removing the language in January. So January, it was a proposal that was different than this one from HUD, and now we have some language again that's being proposed that we need to get some clarification language in, that what they're talking about in terms of available fund does not impact the MTW funds that we have that can be used for things like our development activities that we draw down and expend. So when if you're asking about the money, where it is, it's sitting in locks, and when we have to draw, and we have an obligation from a contract and a resolution, commitment from the board and a obligation through a contract, and it's, and when we need to use it, we go to locks and we draw it down and turn it over right away to whoever we pay. And those are funds that are looking like they're available funds for recapture on the HUD side. So we're really trying to fight the fight to make sure that doesn't occur and we can protect them. And that'll be going on in the next few weeks. I just want to remind one other thing, and I don't know if she's still here. She may have actually gone, but we have a new staff member. Danielle Winford has joined us. She's our new program education program specialist, has been filled, and I believe she may have gone home. She was here earlier, but I'm glad to have that new person on board. We had wait list opening and closing both at Lion Creek Crossing and Cathedral. Lion Creek Crossing, and I didn't pull the numbers, I'm sorry, the exact numbers, but it was over 500 at Lion Creek Crossing, and it was just over 300 were live-work Oakland preferences, the people who are living and working in Oakland. So I was really thrilled that we got that large of a local response. And Lion Creek Crossing, or in Cathedral, opened and closed theirs. They had over 5,000 people apply for their site. Well over 3,000 were live-work Oakland as well. So we're really, I think, getting our outreach is really effective in the city, and I'm happy about that. Other items, we have several upcoming committee meetings I want to remind everyone of. We have a CAHI meeting, OP meeting, OHI, KHI, TASA, Faranga, all in the next month. And we also need to convene a meeting of the Safer Oakland Ad Hoc Committee with commissioners that was established related to comments to the city on their initiative. Okay, so we'll be trying to get some dates from the chair, who's Commissioner Pitts, and try and get that scheduled. And that's specifically for the public safety presentation that we saw at the city. And that next month is our annual meeting, and per our bylaws, the annual meeting actually occurs at 7 o'clock, not at 6 o'clock, so we'll be having our meeting at 7 o'clock. And that concludes my comments.
Okay. Do we have reports from commission committees? Okay. Are there any announcements by commissioners? Okay. Commissioner Castillo.
I really want to appreciate the staff that came out to the photo and story art exhibit. I was told that OHA came out, and it was really good to have that kind of participation from my OHA-ets. And it's still going on. It's the at the Uptown Body and Fender at 401 26th Street, and it's a group of homeless or previously homeless photographers who put on this incredible photo story exhibit, and I do appreciate when we come out to something that local, so thank you so much for that.
Anyone else? All right, then I guess we can take a motion for adjournment.
I'll second.
All right, and so be it. We are adjourned. Very good. Now, we good. Okay. Oh, that's mine? Oh, you're right, that is. Oh, there, huh? Governing states and locality.